This is Victor Cannicelli of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today's date is May 26th. The time is approximately 9:30 Eastern Standard. I'm accompanied by Ryan Bubb of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission and various attorneys for Mr. Siegel and Mr. Jay Siegel. We're at the law offices of Sullivan and Cromwell in New York City for the interview of Mr. Siegel. This interview will be recorded with the consent of Mr. Siegel. Could I get your verbal assent to that, sir?
Yes, you
can. Thank you. Will everyone please state your full name and affiliation for the record, and please spell your last name for the transcriptionist. I'll start. Cannicelli is C-U-N-I-C-E-L-L-I.
Ryan Bubb with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, B-U-B-B.
Jay Siegel, J-A-Y, last name S-I-E-G-E-L.
Steve Ross, R-O-S-S, from Akin Gump, and I'm accompanied by Connie O'Connor.
Steve Ehrenberg of Sullivan and Cromwell, E-H-R-E-N-B-E-R-G, and with me today is Matthew Sullivan, also with S&C.
In the way of background, Mr. Siegel, the FCIC was established by statute, Public Law 111-21, signed into law by the President. It is bipartisan and consists of 10 commissioners. It's charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with composing a report of findings to the President and Congress by 15 December 2010. The commission may compel attendance and testimony of witnesses and production of records. I can provide a copy of the statute by which the commission was formed if you so desire. Please be advised that the FCIC is an agency of the United States, and FCIC staff are federal employees under the aegis of 18 United States Code, Section 1001, concerning false statements. I ask you, or I caution you, that the FCIC requests confidentiality on anything, any topics presented to you today, any questions asked and whatnot, and we'd ask that going forward, of course, with the exception of counsel. Mr. Ross, I believe you had a statement you wanted
yes.
to make.
I just wanted to note for the record, and in particular for anyone who might be later hearing this recording or viewing a transcript, that under the protocol for this voluntary interview, while it is being recorded and we understand that for internal purposes a transcript will be made, that unlike a deposition where we would have the opportunity to make objections as to certain questions or indeed to ask questions on our time that might clarify that this is not such a proceeding, and just wanted the record to note that in that regard, the record that's being created should not be treated as if it were a deposition or other proceeding in which we would have those rights and opportunities.
Okay. Mr. Siegel, just with respect to ground rules when we record, usually Mr. Zbava and myself will give you a sign if we want to hear you talk today. We don't want to interrupt you or anything, but if we want to stop you in the middle of something, we'll put up a finger just saying, hey, could we interject for a moment to clarify or elaborate or whatnot. Mm-hmm. So if you see a finger go up, we just ask you to complete your sentence. But let us get something in, just so we don't talk over one another. And that works two ways. Mm-hmm. If we're asking a question and you need clarification or whatnot, you know, just finger up, ask your clarifying question or whatnot, and we're good with that. Okay. First time you mention a proper name, please spell it for us. I'm sure there's going to be a good deal of financial jargon if you use acronyms or whatnot. If you could explain them the first time, thereafter, the acronym's fine. Anything else? All right. I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Bubb for you.
Okay, and I'll try to remember those, but feel free to correct me.
Thank you.
I'll try to remember them as well. Feel free to correct me.
Okay.
Could you just start by telling us your educational background?
Sure. I went to Dartmouth College. Majored in mathematics and graduated cum laude with honors, which involved writing a senior project, essentially. That was in 1985. Then I went to Columbia Law School. I graduated in 1988 with a JD.
And could you give us your employment history at Moody's when you started and what position you started and what group you started, and then how your responsibilities or your positions evolved until you left Moody's.
Okay, that sounds like a long one. I started in, I think it was June of 94 at Moody's. I had the analyst role in the residential mortgage-backed securities team. I think my title was actually senior analyst, but people who were analysts, senior analysts, and a few other titles all had the analyst function. I stayed in the RMBS team, I think, for 4 years. My title changed. I got promoted to senior credit officer at some point, and then senior vice president. Still performing the analyst function. As with all analysts, the job entailed rating deals, meaning taking the lead role in preparing analyses, going to committee to actually get a formal rating decision, communicating with issuers. We also did research and published papers. As part of those projects, I worked on developing some of the models that we use as tools for rating mortgage, residential mortgage-backed securities, both in the United States and in Australia. And is that enough detail through 1998?
That's great.
Okay. Then I rotated out of structured finance. At the time, I referred to outside structured finance being fundamental, meaning we rated corporations. So I rated a number of different types of corporations, including most by number would be real estate investment trusts. More detail on that, or keep
Great.
Going?
Keep
okay.
Going.
So that involved a few rotation to a few different teams over about a three-year window. Then I came back to the residential mortgage-backed team, I think it was the end of October of 2001, as a team managing director. So I became co-head of the team.
So I say the year again?
2001.
And what were your responsibilities?
My responsibilities were broader. I was overseeing the analysts, overseeing the projects. I chaired rating committees. I was more active in speaking at conferences where investors might listen to our methodology and approaches, more active in issuer relations. Typically, an analyst and a managing director would visit. So given we had 20 and then growing to 40, 50 analysts, managing directors tended to travel more to have one of the two of us at a meeting plus one of the analysts. We were, had a lot of meeting time. Not part of my title, but before 2001, I was also tapped to work, and I think we'll come back to this one in some detail, tapped to work on a modeling project that became known as Moody's Mortgage Metrics. And that started before I had rotated back onto the structured finance team. I think it was late 2000. I guess I announced my resignation in March of 2006, and my last work date was the beginning of April 2006. And I remained by contract. I had a contractual relationship to stay on as a consultant for Moody's Investor Service. And later that shifted to a contract with Moody's Analytics, which is not the rating side of Moody's, where I do training.
For how long did you serve as a consultant to Moody's Investor Service?
But when did the contract change?
Your last effort, your last billable hour.
I think it was January of 2009. I helped, I reviewed a draft of the year in review.
About how many hours a month did you work for Moody's Investor Service as a consultant on average from April 2006 until January 2009?
It started, the first half year to year averaged about 15 to 20 hours a month, and then it dropped off sharply.
When did it drop off?
I guess after the first year until it went to zero with the last year in review. It may even have been a year earlier's year in review. I don't recall that specifically.
And that year, that first year as a consultant, mm-hmm. what did you do for Moody's Investor Services?
Most of it, by time spent, it was reviewing publications and commenting. That was something I also did while I was a managing director. I also draft methodology pieces, for example, and depending on their writing skill, I would comment on that. That's the bulk of it. I was consulted on other issues that weren't in writing or led to a publication as well, analytic issues.
Great. So my primary goal today is to mm-hmm. try and understand better the way Moody's rated residential mortgage-backed securities, which I'll refer to as RMBS.
Okay.
And I want to start back with the 1996 methodology piece, which your name is on. So
okay.
This is hopefully won't be too distant to memory for you. Do you remember this this document? And so what I'm looking at is titled Moody's Approach to Rating Residential Mortgage Pass-Through Securities. The base number is Moody's FCIC 0013453, dated November 8th, 1996.
I remember this. It had been superseded, and it's about 14 years ago. But yes, I have a recollection certainly of it.
So it's my understanding that this laid out in a relatively comprehensive fashion the methodology that was in place, at least as of November 1996.
There was some proprietary information, data particulars that we were not allowed to share. I don't recall what made the data set proprietary, but we treated it as proprietary. So it covered everything that we felt was able to share with the outside.
So I raised this document mostly just to sort of jog your memory as to the procedures that were used by Moody's back in circa 1996, the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Just to start, something I don't understand yet is the extent to which when Moody's was rating an RMBS back then, when Moody's estimated the pool loss distribution, the distribution of losses on the pool of mortgages that back the RMBS, did they always use the loan level data and actually ascribe an expected loss figure to each individual loan? Or was the expected loss calculation sometimes, all the time, based simply on pool level characteristics, for example, weighted average, FICOs, and the like? Could you help us understand the degree to which the expected loss calculation was a loan level model versus a pool level average model?
I started in 94. I can't go back before that. And I know this 1996 model was loan by loan, except for certain characteristics that can only be measured on a pool basis. On a pool basis was the word I intended to use, such as geographic diversity. You can't look at one loan and say, oh, this is geographically diverse or not. You would have a pool of loans. But most of the characteristics were best measured and analyzed at a loan level, and certainly in 96 and forward, we used loan-by-loan analysis.
And in 96 and forward, were issuers then required to provide loan-level data to Moody's in order to rate an RMBS?
There The model, and this is a more general statement, the model is a tool in our overall rating methodology. So if we were going to use this tool, we would have needed loan-by-loan information. There are other elements to the methodology that might not have even required loan-level information. We did some, and I worked on some deals where we didn't have loan-level information. And we assigned them.
And how would those models work if you didn't have loan level information? What would you do, generally?
I can't answer that question generally. It varied by the pool, by the particular deal.
Can you give us some examples?
Sure. If we had seen an issuer's three preceding deals had loan level information, and then, for some reason, on the next deal only had pool level, we would take into account, does this pool information look like the preceding pool's pool level information, and should we therefore impute the same risk that we calculated loan by loan? And in other cases where we couldn't make that sort of comparison, then we could take a pool level analysis using weighted factors for different loan risk characteristics, like high LTV would have a higher risk than a low LTV loan. LTV is loan to value ratio.
So in cases in which the issuer had previously provided loan level data on RMBS that Moody's had rated, and the new pool they were offering to be rated had similar characteristics to the pool level to those previous deals, you would basically use the old deals as a starting point for the ratings.
We would use that as starting point can mean so many different things. We would use that as an input into the, yeah, that would be one consideration in the committee.
And in cases in which an issuer didn't have pools that were similar to the current one, then they would, can you explain again exactly what would occur then, roughly? They would adjust the ratings from the prior pools using differences?
No. You could, if there was no loan level analyzed comparable pool to use as an input, then we would focus more on pool level measures, such as looking at the loan-to-value ratio on average and looking at how many of the loans were vacation properties, which are higher risk than, say, an owner-occupied home, and apply analysis that way. We use Excel spreadsheets. It varies. You're asking for a specific example, but it varies depending on the information.
And was there a specified model that Moody's would use to relate these pool level characteristics to an initial expected loss distribution?
I don't recall that level of detail from 15 years ago.
Sure. For pools that had loan level information under the sort of 96, under the methodology described in this November 8, 1996 document, there was a specified model that Moody's would use to relate those loan characteristics to expected loss. And yes, please take your time to take a look at this to refresh your memory. So with this 1996 methodology, was there a fixed model that Moody's used to relate loan level characteristics to expected loss? For example, a set of functional forms with coefficients that translated LTV ratio and FICO combination into some default frequency and loss prosperity, something more complicated.
I'm quite sure FICO was not used, but sorry. Sure. Ignoring your for example and just going back to the core question, yes, this model would, if 100 people came in and each one put in the same loan characteristics, the model would give them the same answer for the model's expected loss.
What was the software used to implement that model? Was it an Excel spreadsheet?
I don't remember what software was used.
Did you use the software when you were an analyst rating deals back in 1996, 1997?
I only recall that the vast majority of pools were, so we called it running through the model, or run through the model by separate staff, whose job was to run the pools through the model. But in order to get familiar with the model, I can't rule out that people then occasionally go in and actually do some work on it.
How were the relationships between risk characteristics of each loan and the actual default frequency and loss severity estimated? What was the basis for that set of relationships that were used in the model?
I would have to defer all exact details to Jim Schmidbauer. He did a lot of the underlying work as to how they were related.
Schmidbauer?
Oh, his name is on the report. James S-C-H-M-I-D-B-A-U-E-R.
Let me draw your attention to page 3.
Mm-hmm.
Under the heading How Data Sources Are Used, there's a paragraph that says, quote, "We draw on historical data from many sources beyond rated loan pools to determine the relationship between loan characteristics and credit risk. Key data sources are the Mortgage Bankers Association, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, private mortgage insurers, and a database of rated loan pools tracked by Moody's. Default frequency and loss severity data were collected at the individual loan level as well as at the pool level. Historical home price data supplied by Case Shiller Weiss, Inc. and Freddie Mac. Time to foreclosure estimates and economic indicators also play a major role in analysis."
Yes, that's better than it.
Do you recall how far back that historical data went?
I recall that one piece of data included what we call the oil patch stress,
yes.
Where now I believe it was the early 80s, where real estate markets in Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, I think Wyoming and Alaska got caught up in it too. But I am not saying that each of the data sources listed gave us data going back to that point in time.
Were interaction terms captured in the model? And by interaction terms, what I mean is, was it the case that LTV and debt to income ratios were related to default probability in such a way that it was both the levels of both that mattered for the outcome. So, for example, it's not the case that for a high DTI borrower, the model's predicted relationship between LTV and default frequency is the same as for a low DTI borrower, the relationship between default frequency and LTV. Does this make sense, this question?
Could you ask again for me to be sure?
Sure. So one possibility is that the model did not include any interaction terms. And in that world, the way the model works is there's a fixed relationship between, say, DTI and default probability. No matter what the other characteristics of the loans are, there's some fixed relationship. Mm-hmm. The other possibility is that that relationship between DTI and default frequency is actually different for different loans. So, for example, a high LTV loan might have one relationship between DTI and default frequency, and then a low DTI loan would have a different relationship. A low LTV loan would have a different relationship between DTI and default frequency.
Yeah. I don't recall, and it's possible I never knew, if Jim Schmidbauer considered linkages and then discussion, and then if he would have followed that up with discussions as to whether or not to include them in the model.
One way this is sometimes talked about in the industry is as risk layering, where if you have multiple characteristics mm-hmm. indicating risk, that's considered a very high risk loan in a way that captures these interaction effects.
Moody's has used that term as well.
Okay. Do you know whether this 1996 model captured risk layering?
I don't recall if this one included it.
And do you know anything about the functional form of the relationship between different risk characteristics and default frequencies? Were they linear? Were they nonlinear? Were they parametric? Were they nonparametric?
I certainly knew them, but I do not recall now.
And what was the nature of the data? So, for example, you described the data went back to the oil patch days. Was that a loan-level database, mortgages back in the oil patch days, where you had characteristics of the loans and the performance of the loans? Or what was the nature of that data?
I recall some data we only had pool or portfolio sort of level. Some data we only had loan level. But I don't recall whether the loan-level data set was one of the ones that went back to the oil patch.
How frequently did the model change in this period?
I think that's the wrong question. I think our methodology would take into account any new characteristic that would have been presented in the pool. So that would have been as needed and likely frequent. Whether we actually reflected that methodology change in the software of this model, I don't recall how often that happened.
Let me be more precise.
Yes.
The model is able to mathematically relate the characteristics of a given loan and some set of characteristics that the model takes as inputs and output an expected loss for that loan. Is that right? Do I understand the basic framework correctly?
Yes. Well, I don't know if it gives loan level. If you were to put in one loan, yes, it would give the answer for loan.
And when I ask whether the model changes frequently, what I mean is when you submit a loan with fixed characteristics, is it the case that over time the model changes to output different expected losses on that loan with the same characteristics?
Okay. I mean, there was only that 2-year window before I left the team. I think it was rare.
Do you recall it ever changing in that 2-year window?
I don't recall one way or the other.
Who would be responsible? Who was responsible during that period for updating the model, maintaining the model?
Can you put some circumstances around that? Again, like if it's one person, their issuer is doing a certain kind of loan, and they say, I wish the model would have this in there, you know, then it...
So I'll give you an example. This is a period in which FICO scores in particular were just being adopted by originators. And at some point, Moody's started to include FICO scores in its, I suspect, I actually don't know, you'll tell me, Moody's started incorporating FICO scores and expected loss estimates. Who would have been the person who would have figured out how to allow that to be an input into the expected loss predictions of the model?
There is no person designated as knowing that if there were a new element, such as FICO, coming along, that they were going to get the phone call and they were going to be told to incorporate it.
Who in practice did? You know, you remember any examples of people who in practice did do that sort of model incorporation?
I don't recall changes during that two-year window.
Were there version numbers for the model? Would you refer to, oh, we ran this pool through model 4.7? Or was it not tracked in that way?
I don't recall.
How were originators factored into the model? Was it the case that one originator would get... a different outcome for a loan with a fixed set of characteristics than another originator? Or were originators just not part of the modeled output? And I believe this document...
refer to the document.
Let me find... This does talk about originator factors.
I'm refreshing my recollection by reading page 5.
At the bottom.
The section begins, originator practices and loan programs are captured in the revised approach, and continues on to page 6. there's a sentence, we now summarize our view of each originator through a factor applied to the expected loss estimate. Okay, among the most important of the model inputs, this scale factor is a shorthand way of indicating our view as to the overall quality of underwriting, origination, and servicing practices. Does that need explanation?
Yeah. Do you remember the use of these originator factors in expected loss estimates? Does this ring a bell?
Now I've read it, certainly rings a bell. I know we incorporated our view of the originator, but I did not recall exactly how it was applied. And this report seems to make clear that it was a factor applied to the expected loss estimate.
Do you recall how these originator factors were estimated or determined during this period?
Yeah, continuing on with the reading describes some of the aspects used to determine the quality and performance of the originator, such as past performance, appraisal standards, and others. So we would, each originator, in order to assess these, like many of Moody's conclusions, there would be a review of the originator's performance, practices, appraisal standards, et cetera.
Did you ever participate in those reviews?
Yes.
How
Analysts participated in operations reviews or originator reviews?
About how frequently would any given originator be subject to a review and a possible adjustment to their originator factor?
I don't recall in 1996 how often.
Do you recall who some of the lowest quality originators were as expressed in the originator factor?
I don't recall that now either.
Do you recall, so are all these originator factors greater than or equal to one, or are some less than one? That is, are there some originators for which you adjust downward from the model's predictions?
Mm-hmm.
And then some you adjust upward?
Yes. I was lead analyst on Chase at one point in time, and they were below one. had very strong performance compared to the historical data set that was used to develop the model.
Do you recall any originators whose originator factor was above one?
I don't recall by name, but having been in committees, there were certainly cases where the originator factor line was greater than one.
And were these... So I would think that subprime originators would get a factor greater than one. Is that generally right? Are they often the ones who are above one? Just roughly, it doesn't need to be with great precision.
No, I wouldn't conclude that the risks that you're identifying were isolated to the originator factor and then applied in the model. I don't recall if that's how it was done or not, but I would agree that the standard practice in subprime had weaker appraisal standards than in prime, for example.
And those were the way the model captured those was through the originator factor.
Again, I just said I don't recall if it was used as a factor benchmarked against prime or if there is some other way to take the subprime paradigm and impute it into the results.
How were housing prices factored into the model, if at all?
And I guess if I could refer to the if you give me a minute to refer to pages 7 and 8 of the document, where Regional Economic Outlook offers a starting point with one heading, and then Housing Market Must Be Incorporated is another. I don't independently recall if I can review these sections.
Why don't you review these sections in hopes of jogging some of your memory? You can just read it, and then let me know when you're ready. I'll ask you some questions.
Okay, I've read those sections. Did you have a particular question, Ryan?
I do. On page 8, it describes, in the second paragraph under the heading "Housing Market Must Be Incorporated," the document states, quote, "Our estimate of a particular area's economic prospects, updated at least annually, is represented by a factor that raises or lowers the loan's default frequency and severity estimate. While else equal, the stronger the outlook for a given housing market, the lower the default frequency and severity for loans originated in that market." Do you recall the use of these factors that represent a particular area's economic prospects?
Yes, I now recall the use of those factors.
How often were they in practice updated?
That I don't recall.
At what geographic level were the factors set? Was it statewide, zip code level? Something else?
That I don't recall either.
How were they determined?
Uh, I only recall generally that we would look at the current and recent economic data and use that to inform the projection going forward. But I don't recall more particulars than that.
And can you describe a little more how mechanically and practice these were applied? So, for example, when you run a pool through the model, does the model itself apply these factors? Or is it the case that the model would output some expected loss, and then the analyst would look up the appropriate factor for the pool and apply the factor after on the model's output? Does this question make sense?
Yes. If I understand, you're asking whether the analyst will see some housing market factor to consider in committee versus the model's expected loss already having incorporated the application, let's say multiplication of that factor, into the model's calculation.
That's right. And to my knowledge, I don't think the document says.
Yeah, my recollection is that this housing market factor is embedded in the model's expected loss calculation, and then the calculation of geographic diversity, I don't recall because that was listed separately. So I don't recall if that meant apply it separately or if embedded in here it is for your consideration in committee.
So I
want to point out that it has the same effect, that our methodology includes using the model as a tool and then discussing, do we want to go with the model or not in this particular case? For example, the model saying economic diversity factor is this. Do we want to use it or not? Whether it had already been embedded and we have to back it out, or whether it hadn't been embedded and we add it in, you get to the same result. But I'm happy to try to explain, to the best of my recollection, the mechanics, if that's what's of interest to you.
So going back to my earlier question about changes to the model, updating of these housing market factors or economic prospect factors, mm-hmm. let's call these, just for the sake of our conversation, we'll call these factors the housing market factors. I don't know if that's the terminology. Is that the terminology Moody's used?
I don't recall.
We'll adopt it for our purposes. Updating these housing market factors would constitute an update to the model as I defined it earlier.
Okay.
Does that sound right?
I don't remember how you defined it earlier.
So I defined it earlier as, let's take the same loan and run it through the model. Do we get a different answer?
Okay.
If we get a different answer, we're going to call that an update to the model.
Okay.
So do you agree that in that definition, these guys are an update to the model?
Yeah.
So who would be responsible for determining these housing market factors?
I don't recall who did it.
And when you were team MD, were you involved at all in determining these housing market factors?
That's fun too. When I came back in 2001, no.
How important were these housing market factors? Were they as important as the originator factors, less important?
I don't recall having just reviewed the document, the third paragraph in the housing market must be incorporated section. Points out that in the development stage, there was a question of how much weighting to give to the economic forecast. And this report characterizes the impact attributable to a particular state outlook as having been kept small. And then for people who don't have the whole report in front of them, I would clarify that the stress environments where a security trying that might achieve a AAA rating versus a lower, say, BAA kind of rating, those stresses were handled other than by looking at what you defined as a housing market factor. So I want to be crystal clear that by saying the impact of the housing market factor was small, it doesn't mean that consideration of home price declines was kept small in any way. Two different things. And anyone with the document in front of them, I think it would be clear but for the tape record.
So, forgive me, that's actually not clear to me, but that may be due to my slowness. So help me. How else were the housing prices factored in? Can you explain your statement?
Sure. Yeah. Indirectly, let me actually, since we have the document in front of us. The model would output loss and standard deviation measures for a pool. Standard deviation is a mathematical term for a statistical measure of what sort of results to expect that differ from your average case. So the model would output those. One reason that you would expect realistically and expect statistically for a particular pool to behave differently than expected is because in the case of mortgages, the economic environment doesn't follow a single predefined path of, you know, home prices always move this way and unemployment always stays here and interest rates are always kept at this level. It's not we don't have a controlled economy. In a market economy, the reason you would have variance and standard deviation is because, among other things, home prices move from time to time. So there's an incorporation by having the analysts look at mean and standard deviations and variance off of the mean. They're incorporating elements such as economic shifts into the analysis, different than the home market factor that we discussed.
So do I understand correctly that the home market factor merely shifts the mean of the distribution, and the standard deviation, which is in part capturing variance due to different economic environments, captures the home price effect. If home prices fell, that's being represented by realizations far to the right of the mean, the higher loss than the mean. Is that right? Do I understand this correctly? Can we break it up into parts?
Yeah, break it up into parts.
First part, housing price factor, as we've defined that term, is only shifting the mean of the distribution?
You need more information, and the answer to that is actually no in a technical sense. It directly has an impact only on the mean loss for the loans and thus the pool. The standard deviation actually itself is partly a function of the mean. So indirectly, anything that affects the mean also affects the standard deviation. So to be complete, the housing market factor does not directly, independently influence the variability, but it indirectly influences the standard deviation.
That's very helpful. So can you explain more how the standard deviation is set?
I recall a few inputs to it, but I don't want to claim that I recall every element of it. I will spend a minute seeing if it's described in here to jog my memory.
So I can kind of help jog your memory a bit. So on page 9,
thank you,
it mentions that the standard deviation is scaled by the pool size, the number of mortgages in the pool. More mortgages than a pool imply presumably a lower standard deviation.
Yes.
Elsewhere in the document, on page 8, under the heading Regional Diversification.
Mm-hmm. That one I remember.
They described how high concentration of mortgages in a particular MSA or a zip code would result in adjustments to the standard deviation. Presumably, it would increase standard deviation.
Yes, high concentration would increase standard deviation, and low concentration would tend to decrease variability.
What else was used? I don't think there's anything else in here. I don't recall anything else in here that describes how standard deviation was set.
The one I remembered was the geographic diversification, and I certainly agree number of pool size. It's obvious that it has to have an impact. And then, as I mentioned, expected loss have an impact on standard deviation.
And why is that? Is that a general feature of the log normal distribution that you need to link these things, or this is some choice?
No. It's not the reasons you said. It's a nature of statistics that there is a relationship between standard deviation and mean. So the can I use an example?
Please.
Just to illustrate this one point, and I'm not saying mortgages behave this way or not. If you look at snowfall in New York Central Park in December, the average might be 15, and some years you'll go up to 30, and some you'll go down to 8 or 0. Your standard deviation might then about equal the mean. It makes sense to people that you're not going to see 8 times that number. You wouldn't see 8 times a 15-inch snowfall in 1 year in Central Park. People just feel that way, and statistics bear it out. If you look at snowfall in October, that might happen once every 15 years. I hope I'm getting the weather right, but I'm using this for illustration. The mean would be 0.000. It would be a very small number, yet the one time you have it, the 1 year you have it, it'll be a few inches. It'll be a large multiple of the mean. So there's, and again, just to illustrate, there are reasons to think that the same applies to the sort of analysis done on this mortgage pool, but would be harder to explain.
How did Moody's determine what relationship to use between the mean loss of a pool and its standard deviation?
I don't recall the details now.
How generally does Moody's figure out those sorts of relationships in their models? What's the general approach?
A first cut for doing a calculation like that would be to look if there's a historical relationship, and then deciding if the historical relationship is one that's robust enough to use as a starting point for the projections going forward.
Your last question, were you asking about generally at this time, or are you asking a timeless question?
A timeless question.
Mm-hmm. And do you understand the difference?
Yes, I understand the difference. That's a good starting point to use for determining relationships, is to look if there's a historical relationship.
So I want to make sure I'm capturing, that I understand all the ways that Moody's incorporated the possibility of a housing market decline into its expected loss estimates. So you had said, you had cautioned me that the housing market factors were not the only way, and that the standard deviation was another modeling approach to capturing the possibility of a housing market decline. What were the other ways? Help me understand how else Moody's captured this.
I think you started, if I heard you correctly, you started the question with a faulty premise of saying baking in home price declines into expected loss. I don't know that the expected case decline necessarily include the home price decline. And I don't recall for this model if we looked to get the expected case using a variety of scenarios, including the downward ones, or if it came about the expected case another way.
And do you recall any other way that the model incorporated the possibility of a housing market decline, say to rate a AAA tranche of RMBS?
I don't recall any other direct ways. I could go through each factor here and see if the reason they add risk to a pool is because in a declining home price environment, defaults are going to increase because of the feature. For example, balloon mortgage, I happen to open to page 9, balloon mortgage instruments. Those are riskier and they were given a risk factor. But one might argue in a rising home price environment, when the balloon comes due in 10 years, there's no added risk. So there may very well be numerous cases where there's an indirect taking into account of home price declines and coming up with other factors such as that one. And if you want me to go through each one, I could.
It's okay.
Okay.
So help me understand better how the model output was used in the ratings process. So as I understand it, an analyst, in the case of a pool where Moody's has loan-level data, will run that pool data through the model, produce
they it. Or someone else would run the pool, with we call it clean the data. You can imagine with so many different originators, not everyone remembers how Moody's codes a limited documentation loan, for example. So clean the data and then run it through the model.
After the model comes an expected loss and a standard deviation. As I understand from reviewing this document, those are then used as the parameters of a log normal distribution for a loss in the pool. So on page 10, there's a nice picture, which I appreciate, of a log normal distribution, a log normal density function, to be more precise. And then what happens next in the story, the rating story? And please correct me if I've gotten the earlier stages wrong. Please help me get it right.
So the model output does include what you said. It also includes more details, in essence, showing how the model reached its conclusion. So it would show in a summary form that the expected loss is made high in part because of no documentation loans, made high in part because of more loans with high loan-to-value ratios. It would show details about the geographic concentration. There were many, many factors on that. I recall we always struggled to fit all the data on a page, and it moved on to a couple of pages. There may have been chart output, but I don't recall which of our tools had chart and graph outputs. So the analyst would take the model mean and standard deviation and these components that show how the model reached it, and then discuss in committee whether the consensus. Do I need to explain the committee process, or who's in the committee and how it's formed? Or
nope.
Should I assume people know that?
Let's assume people know we have a committee that's been formed through Moody's standard committee procedures.
Okay.
And sort of what is the substantive work of the committee and analysis of the committee to come up with
the rating?
Okay,
it's to consider how much weight to give to the model output as provided versus making adjustments. So I don't recall now, 15 years later, what the most common reasons were for challenging the model and arguing to go up or down. And even that would change from one pool to another. It would be, the committee would include the lead analyst who's very familiar with the originator. There might be something commonly known about the originator. This originator is just an example from a more recent case that may have applied way back then. This originator's particular way of making a limited documentation loan takes into account so many offsetting features that the model's penalty for low documentation loan based on its historical analysis of a general underlying data set overstates risk. And for another originator, it might be the opposite, that their limited doc is calls for the risk level to be increased versus the model. So that would be an example of the kind of topic that would come up in committee.
And that issue wouldn't be captured by the originator factors because those are applied to every loan rather than just the low documentation loan. Do I understand this right?
The lead analyst would know as well what to what extent the factors might be overlapping. So if it were incorporated into the originator factor because we knew they would always have 20% low doc and we knew their low doc was always good or always strong, it would be baked in. If it varied from pool to pool, deal to deal, then it might not make sense to include in the originator factor. It might make sense to talk about it outside. But the lead analyst at the time knows more about that than I recall about it 15 years later.
And then, so then the committee, after doing its analysis,
the committee would also, they would also do comparisons to, it would be typical to show comparisons to other deals. Let's say there had been a shift in opinion. We received data from a comparable originator showing their deals were performing worse than we had originally expected, and now we get a pull from a different originator but similar loan characteristics. We'd want to take that into account, almost like a legal, you guys are lawyers, right? Almost like a legal precedent, right? There's a decision somewhere else based on new information or new analysis. You'd want to have that come to bear on your decision.
So I'd seen references in Moody's documents to comparison pools, which you refer to?
Yes, that sounds like a good way to refer to what I just described, is taking a pool of comparable characteristics from another originator.
And some of the ways I've seen this described is they'll have found often a pool from the same originator, earlier pool from the same originator, mm-hmm. and they'll describe the credit enhancements that were required on that earlier sort of precedent pool.
Again, Moody's wouldn't say required because I think I mentioned that Moody's doesn't, when Moody's has its way of looking at things, the originator is free to not to do things a different way. And the rating will change accordingly, but it's not like we're a regulator. We say you can only originate this type of loan. Rather, we say if you originate a loan that doesn't meet the standard, your rating will be lower.
Let me clarify.
Because that's not maybe that's more technicality with Moody's, but I just want to...
Yep, let me clarify. And please correct me if I'm mistaken in my understanding of this. Ultimately, Moody's will communicate on a particular pool that for a given rating, say AAA, the AAA bonds need X percentage in credit enhancement, usually achieved through subordination, for Moody's to rate that bond associated with that pool as AAA. Do I understand that correctly?
Again, you may see this as a technical distinction, but the originator, even if we give feedback such as that, that it would include a number of other conditions to it. So it would be, if you repeat the same structure as your last deal, for example, and want to structure it to have a senior bond AAA, then a 4% credit support would get you to AAA. But that's not in any way intended to tell the originator you're not allowed to structure the deal differently with a guarantee
something
and come back with a pool that's 3%, but it has something else.
I understand. Okay. So at the end of the day, make sure I understand this right, for a given pool that Moody's rating committee is rating, they do vote on a credit enhancement level for the bonds in that deal to be rated AAA. Is that correct?
You're saying in that deal, so meaning given that structure and all the other information we need to evaluate the deal, then yes.
And indeed, in the ratings committee they're called ratings memorandum? Memoranda, is that the term? Rating memorandum?
You can call them rating committee memos.
Okay, in the rating committee memo,
yeah,
they report what the credit enhancements for that particular deal were as determined by the committee. Is this right?
It's beyond my scope of knowledge to say whether each rating committee memo that was ever written has that information.
Generally.
Yes.
Yeah, and so now we have some foundation, common understanding of what I'm referring to. It's those enhancement levels that are reported typically in a ratings memo.
Mm-hmm.
When I've seen these comparison deals mentioned, they're often mentioned with, and this was the credit enhancements required for AAA on this deal. Mm-hmm. And I see people say, we think that's about right for this deal. There's no reason to, the pools are comparable, they look the same, there's no reason to adjust them. Is this how people use the comparison deals, or tell us more about this?
It can be. You're treating it as a, you're not saying it, but if you're implying that, it can be a very brief exercise. It takes some effort on the analyst to compare the pools, but certainly after analysis and comparison of two pools, if they find the risk to be the same, then that would be one argument that the analyst would make.
And if loan level data were provided,
I just want to make sure we're not creating a confusing record in terms of time, because some of your questions have been generally, does Moody's do this? Obviously, Mr. Siegel has not been involved in the rating process since he left, and there's some going back and forth in discussion of the memo as to the model and 96 in general. And so I'm not sure Mr. Siegel can speak to sort of a general practice.
We only want to know about the practices that you participated in when you were at Moody's. Absolutely.
Clarification.
So don't speculate as to what Moody's does today, what Moody's did before you arrived. Mm-hmm. We just want to know about your experience with Moody's. This is why we're talking to you. It's because you have extensive experience rating these deals.
And my discussion was based on you said you were trying to understand how this model worked.
That's
and
right.
Would use. So this is for deals where we use this model.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay.
And just to be really clear,
and I don't have to repeat that every.
Absolutely not. And until we get to it, and we are going to get to it, I'm not talking about the use of the M3 model, which you referred to earlier, which I understand is a little bit different from, or maybe a lot different. It's different from this model. So
okay.
Talking about using this 1996 based methodology and how committees used it.
Okay.
So when a pool came in with loan level data, was it always the case that the loan level data was run through this model and the results presented to the committee? Or on some occasions, did they simply rate it based on precedent deals, comparison pools, say from the same originator, that look very similar?
I don't recall if we. I don't recall.
You said earlier that in cases in which an originator only provided pool level data, and Moody's had experience with that originator, comparison pools, then it could rate the deal.
Those were usually, that stopped happening after a while.
When did it stop happening?
I think it was the Department of Justice told us we couldn't rate deals where the issuer wasn't didn't have a certain level of involvement. I don't know all the details.
When was that?
I don't recall when that was.
Was it in prior to your was it in your first stint in the RMBS group?
I don't recall if it concluded then or after I left the team.
And
I know it had not happened before I got there, or else I wouldn't have referred to the cases where we did it.
And just to make sure I understand, under this agreement with the DOJ, or whatever it was with the DOJ, issuers had to provide loan-level data henceforth.
Moody's was... That's not the tack they were taking? That's not the issue they were addressing?
Sorry, what issue
were
they
addressing? I mean, I was not directly involved in the DOJ discussions, and it may have actually occurred while I was off the team.
Sorry, maybe I misunderstood. I thought you said that after this DOJ action, issuers henceforth would always provide loan-level data? Is that not what you said? What did you say before?
If we were to... But the DOJ was not telling us what kind of data to get or not. The DOJ was... looking for the issuer to be participating in the writing process.
Let me just ask a really precise question. After the DOJ action, was it Moody's practice to always get loan-level data from issuers and rating RMBS?
We would not have had a policy about saying we couldn't do it with pool level, so no. But I can't recall a specific case where we had pool level information rather than loan by loan level information after that.
And I don't understand yet about the comparison pools.
Mm-hmm.
If you have the model's outputs, why would you also go get a comparison pool?
The comparison pool was a way to, remember I described the, and again this is going back to this model, the model output included the expected loss and enough additional information about pool characteristics for a committee to consider how closely they wanted to follow the model or not. The comparison pool, to compare two pools, you would look at that very same information. So you would take the model output or the equivalent statistics from one deal versus another and look at them. If we did not have a committee process and only used model output and said model output is the answer no matter what, then I could see your point, your argument that let's just run the model, your suggestion that Moody's would only run the model. But if two pools are identical, let's say the originator got feedback, they decided to do the deal, but in between the time of original feedback and not, one of the borrowers prepaid and another borrower was found to have breached the rep and warranty and was pulled from the deal. So instead of the original 1,030 loans, we had 1,028 loans. You can imagine any number of summary ways to determine if the risk has changed in that pool. If the two loans pulled out were very close to the pool average, it might be, it would, in my view, be very viable to rate the deal the same as the original pool without the need for running a model.
So there were cases where the deal was rated based on the precedent and not based on running the model.
There would have been cases where the final pool wouldn't have been run through the model, and the final committee conclusion would have been based on a comparison, but I'm not saying that in that comparison chain there isn't model output at some stage that rooted the original committee decision.
In the comparison pool?
Yes.
I see. Yep. So it all eventually, all roads lead back to the model in some sense. These comparison pools were rated with the model at some point back in their line.
In practice, yes, but the committed result is more important to me than the model result. The committed result includes more elements than the model result. If you say, here's a committed result, I wouldn't say, oh, did it go through the model? That wouldn't even be the question. But in practice, such a high majority of pools were run through the model that, yeah, you would always be able to tie in.
Is very helpful. I'm starting to understand slowly. When you came back in 2001, what if anything had changed about Moody's methodology since 98? Sorry, when you came back to the RMBS group in 2001?
Well, we had developed a new model for prime pools called Moody's Mortgage Metrics.
It was developed as of 2001?
It was being worked on, assuming the day I came back, remember what was, I don't recall getting a list of here's exactly where everything, how everything happened 3 years earlier, and here's exactly where everything happens today.
Mr. Ross, are you going to be switching to the next time period, the 2001 time period?
Yes.
And if so, is this a reasonable time to maybe take a short mid-morning break?
Sure. How long do we have you for, Mr. Siegel, this morning?
That's really sort of, generally speaking, up to you guys when you want to start with the next witness.
Okay, so you've got some flexibility on your end?
Yeah, some.
When should we plan to let you go by? What is it? When does it become very difficult for you to stick around and enlighten us?
I guess I was targeting 12:30, but 1 o'clock would be if you need longer.
And would we be able to get back in touch with you to have another conversation if we haven't gotten through the material we want to get through today by one?
By phone or? Sort of a phone follow-up, or
could be by phone or in person. I mean, ideally, we get it all done today. So, if you've got more flexibility than one, we might see if you would be so kind as to give it to us. Otherwise, we can certainly follow up.
There's a particular commitment that I can check on during the break, and then let you know if there's more flexibility.
Great, thanks, appreciate it.
Okay.
Sure.
I've got 10:50. We'll go off record. I've got 11:10 a.m. We're back on record. No substantive discussions while we were off record, Mr. Ross. Okay.
Ryan, I thought that you mentioned that before we stopped the recording that we were moving on to the time frame, but one of your questions, we got cut off because there are so many nuances to it. You were asking to explain the part of the rating process where we move from the model output and the expected loss to the rating. And I don't know if I got back to the core point, and this may actually already be known to you from the materials, that the committee's credit support, as we've discussed, for rated securities at investment grade, or certainly for the highest of investment grades, say AAA, by applying the mean plus standard deviations, reflects a substantial stress case versus what one might experience in a rising home price environment. So if the AAA level for a deal is 8% and the expected loss is 1%, there's a substantial cushion against what might be expected in a benign economic environment, and that's a way to reflect stresses, including economic stresses, including home price stresses. And I think the way you asked the questions leading up to that, that was clear, but I just wanted to tie it back to your particular question about how the analysts move from model output to credit support for rated securities. Yep. And how that bakes in home price stresses, including declines. Yep. Including consideration of these historical home price decline environments that are discussed in the report.
Yep. During the break, I was reflecting, and I think maybe I didn't give a sort of enough of a preamble to sort of explain sort of what it is that I'm about, what this whole exercise is about. It's like, let me back up for a second. So we're from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, which I'm sure you understand. The goal of the commission is to understand the causes of the financial crisis. And Congress laid out in the statute that established us a whole set of factors. There are 10 commissioners who were appointed by both Republicans and Democrats in Congress, mm-hmm. who have also given the staff, Mr. Cunicelli and I are on the staff of the commission, other topics that we're investigating so we can inform the commission. Mm-hmm. The commission is ultimately going to write a report, and that report is due December 15th and aims to be an account of the causes of the financial crisis. What the commissioners have asked us to do in particular is understand, is to learn how mortgage-related securities were rated. Since obviously those mortgage-related securities didn't perform terribly well over the last 3 years, and losses to those securities played a key role, losses to investors on those securities played a key role in the financial crisis. We're trying to understand how they got rated investment grade to begin with. While I am nominally a lawyer, I'm a member of the bar, I'm not really a lawyer. I'm really a social scientist. I'm trained as an economist. And my role is to, by talking to people like you and others, is to educate these 10 commissioners to try and explain to them, hey, here's how Moody's, for example, S&P, came up with these ratings. And while we've got a reporter on and it has the flavor of a formal deposition, and Mr. Ross has been great about clarifying things to the record, you know, the main goal is not so much to get a precise record, although that's surely a good thing. It's for me to understand exactly how these models work so I can then educate our commissioners. So your help in helping me get up to speed on these is really valuable.
Okay. I hope you mentioned your opinion on the performance of the rated securities. I hope that you have end up having the time to make distinctions and, you know, rather than issue blanket statements about ratings performance. You know, there's some types of securities and some time periods and et cetera.
Absolutely. And Moody's has been very good about giving us data that allows us to make those distinctions between vintages and types of securities, some of which perform much worse than others. So with that as a backing up as a preamble, I have one last question actually about the earlier period, the 96, 97, 98 period in this 96 model. What exactly was available to issuers of these securities? Could they actually run the model themselves on data? Or was the model kept internal?
The model was kept internal. Yep. The biggest driver in that decision, or I guess that'd be my opinion at the time, of the biggest, I consider the biggest driver, yep. was that we used the proprietary data to come up with the model, and it wouldn't have been appropriate to share with them more detail than was in the report.
So the report was their main source for understanding how the model worked, how different characteristics were factored into the model, or did they have other sources of information in addition to the report that you know of?
We made the report available, and I did presentations on the model. I don't know which one they would consider the main or the most important to each of them, but they could always talk to Moody's.
Yep.
And they wouldn't get the proprietary information by talking to Moody's, but they could talk to us about clarifying areas of the report, after time understanding how the model was working as to their particular deals.
On page 10 of the report,
yes,
it has this nice picture of the probability density function of pool loss. And you started our second session here describing how for the AAA tranche, the credit support level, which on the figure is denoted by CS, this is figure 4, is well to the right of the mean of the distribution. It's somewhere out on the tails. And so do I understand correctly that, like, suppose this is the actual credit support for the AAA in a deal. That is, this is what went out as the credit support for the AAA bonds after Moody's rated it. The notion here is that that point of the distribution is supposed to represent things like housing prices have crashed and defaults went up. Was that what you were trying to explain, or explain it in the context of this?
Sure, yeah. The, so yeah, there's at least one thing you said that isn't correct. So you can't tell from the... Someone might be able to look at this picture, measure the tail from the picture, and say, boy, that's a lot of loss for AAA, or that's too little loss. I shouldn't... So that might or might not be the point for a AAA rating.
Understood.
Okay, but if we were to just take in a hypothetical illustration of a log normal of a distribution, it would have been log normal, and the loss scenarios occurring in what you describe as the tail, meaning the right-hand tail, would reflect environments of different levels of stress. Mostly, especially now, we know economic sorts of stress, although there might be environments out there that are stressful for other reasons. Yeah. There could have been an originator fail to follow their practices on appraisal review, and that pool ended up in the tail.
Yep.
So it was... It's any number of reasons, but mostly it would be driven by, now we know, economics to be in the right-hand side of the tail.
So getting these tails right is obviously important for providing sufficient credit support for the AAA. And the process you described, and that's described in this document for determining the mean of this distribution and the standard deviation of this distribution, I'm having trouble understanding how, and maybe this is just not your, maybe you simply don't know, and this is other people we should be asking, but how the empirical basis for which those relationships between loan characteristics and pool characteristics and ultimately the expected loss and the mean of this distribution and standard deviation, whether that was truly, whether it's particularly the standard deviation, whether it was really truly rooted in some sort of empirical understanding or historical data set understanding. Can you help me understand exactly how they figured out what the standard deviation ought to be for a given pool in a way that actually reflected the true probability distribution of, for example, the possibility of a national decline in housing prices?
If you had asked me in 1996, I would have been the guy and I could have told you that. But we discussed standard deviation before. I know that the mean was an input into it, the number of loans, and the geographic diversity.
Yeah.
I don't recall if there were a couple more in addition to that. And I know a starting point for analysis like that would be to see if there's a historical relationship between them, to the extent the report specifically references the decline in home prices in Texas. People would have considered whether the credit support levels, or would they have covered what we've seen? But at this point in time, I can't think of other details unless you want to try to ask a more specific question on how the standard deviation was determined.
And obviously, since 2006, housing prices have fallen dramatically. I don't know the exact numbers, but it's north of 30% nationally, at least as measured in Case-Shiller. Was the degree of housing price decline that we've actually experienced was there any way for the possibility of that to have been factored into the standard deviation? That is, was it, in fact, to your knowledge, factored into the standard deviation?
If you're asking a statistical question rather than a practical question, the standard deviation has no limit. Once a committee might have agreed to use a log normal distribution and a mean and standard deviation to describe that log normal distribution.
Yep.
One could imagine a scenario of the remotest probability, to be sure, where the statistics would say your loss is 150% of your balance, right? Which we know in practice you can't lose more than 100% or
it'd be a bad mortgage.
There's no inherent statistical limit to a mean and standard deviation approach to say what's the likelihood of even a one-day 80% decline in home prices nationwide. Someone who accepts the mean and the distribution would be able to find and calculate a probability of that remote event occurring.
That's not my question.
Yeah, well, okay, that's what you asked it statistically. That's what I'm saying, but you might.
Okay, no, that's not more practical. That's certainly not what I want to learn. So let me put it this way: on the x-axis of this figure is measured the dollar loss in the pool, you know, there is some dollar loss associated with, say, a 30% decline in home prices over 3 years, and it's large. it's more than the mean, to say the least. And one, you know, could sort of find that point on this distribution and then think, look, are we assigning enough probability weight to losses at this level or greater? I don't understand how Moody's thought about that problem and thought about how to get the tails right. And this is the practical question that I'm trying to get at. I truly don't understand, and I'd love to. And I appreciate you may not remember, so that's fine. But if you do, I mean, please enlighten us.
Certainly there are some points, I think, relevant to your question that I remember, and I can tell from the publication. One is the decision to use a log normal distribution would have been considered. Is this a distribution that seems to give us an appropriate measure of high loss events?
Yep.
It's a log normal distribution is substantially more has substantially larger tails, so shows substantially more likelihood of high loss events than, say, a normal distribution. So at some point it was determined, don't treat this, the housing market, like coin flips. There's more to it than that. It's worse than that. The likelihood of having, a 8 times normal loss in mortgages is different than more stressful than having the mathematically corresponding question for coin flips and having so many heads flipped in a row. So that was one element of the discussion that would have been historical, that would have been analyzed against historical data, looking at historical performance through different downturns that had been observed. Would give some points on a distribution like this.
So I've read, and I don't know if this is actually true, that the last time we had a national housing price decline over like a full calendar year was the Great Depression. Do you know whether Moody's, in looking at historical data and considering these issues of whether they're distribution would have fat enough tails on these high loss events, whether they thought about the possibility of a Great Depression like housing market decline or more generally a national housing price decline over a full calendar year,
Mm-hmm. I don't recall all the discussions on the scenarios. I do recall Texas, and I know that it's also printed in here. Is what I recall at this point.
So moving forward, your 2001 through 2006 stint at in the RMBS group at Moody's, so let's start by talking about the M3 model. So I understand that the M3 model was in development when you returned in 2001. I believe it was rolled out for rating deals in 2003. Is that right?
I don't recall. That seems... I should have just stopped there. That seems later than... And it would have taken.
But it was after, it was only after 2001 when we released Cabinet.
Generally, yes, just in case someone's going to get technical with this, some of the research that we did to develop Moody's Mortgage Metrics, which is the model that you're referring to as M3, and maybe I will, maybe I won't because of trademark issues. One element of the research for Moody's Mortgage Metrics was the impact of FICO scores on prime loan performance.
Yep.
And the results were, for that single factor, were so compelling that the team implemented a FICO adjustment in committees into the process. Prior to the full rollout of Moody's Mortgage Metrics. So while the Moody's Mortgage Metrics rollout, that's the day we could all look up, some of the work on M3 was incorporated into our methodology earlier on, I believe, in 2001.
And was that FICO adjustment actually built into the model from the 96 tool? Or was it something that was a post-model adjustment?
There was a separate, I believe it was an Excel spreadsheet that people would use. So you'd go to committee with the core model's output, and you'd take the Excel spreadsheet. And then I don't know over time mechanically when it got incorporated, so I also wouldn't have to bother doing the two separate steps.
But you think it was ultimately incorporated into just the first model?
I think it was, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
And eventually, for prime pools, analysts stopped using that model altogether and used M3.
Right.
So there might have, if that happened quickly enough, there would have been no need to incorporate it. But that's where I'm not sure.
I see. And
it's a matter of time. Either way, you get the same answer, whether it's in the model
absolutely.
Or outside the model.
Absolutely.
So it's
absolutely.
Whether it was going to save people's time or not be worth the effort because M3 was going to be rolled out.
Now, the M3, when it was ultimately rolled out, was, at least for some initial period, only for prime, jumbo, and Alt-A pools and not for subprime pools.
It was not for subprime, and I wouldn't even say broadly for Alt-A. I think there were a subset of Alt-A that it was...
Do you remember what subset of Alt-A or how that was divided up between M3 and the earlier model?
I don't.
Presumably it was the better Alt-A pools that would go to M3. And
the ones closer to the data set used for prime, so maybe... No, I mean, I'd be speculating. Loans that were not part of prime jumbo because of only one single characteristic, you know, would be more, in my view today, would be better candidates for running in the original Moody's Mortgage Metrics than loans that had multiple risk characteristics.
And was the decision of whether to use M3 to model a loan's expected loss or a pool's expected loss, or loss distribution more generally, was that made at a loan level or at a pool level, or how is that determined?
How does M3 calculate expected loss?
No, I'm sorry. So okay. Poole comes in to Moody's, and the analyst has to decide what tool to use to model expected loss in the pool. The analyst can use M3. Mm-hmm. The analyst could use this earlier tool, which as far as I know doesn't have a name. I wish we had a name for it. It'd be easy to reference. The 96 as updated okay. tool or whatever. I would call it M2, but that's just nonsense. How would the analysts figure out which tool to use? Could they use both for different parts of the pool? Just what was that procedure or methodology?
I don't recall. I know the publication referred to prime pools, and analysts knew which pools were prime pools, so those were no-brainers yep. to include. I don't recall about loans that were on the line.
Okay. And do you recall, was it ever the case that some loans were run through M3 for a given pool, some of its loans were run through M3, some of its loans were run through the earlier model?
I don't recall one way or the other.
And I've seen a reference to that in something called, quote, Alt-B pools, which is not a term I'm actually that familiar with. Mm-hmm. Does this ring any bells?
The term Alt-B rings a bell, but I'm not sure the context in which you saw it. But I saw it in the context of pools of loans that were riskier than traditional Alt-A.
Yep.
But were... But the inquiry was whether they're safer than subprime, so occupying space in between subprime and all day.
Right. So what I'd seen was that it...
Do you have it with you?
So I actually have some readings memoranda that we'll go through once you kind of get through the general discussion, okay. some of which have this Alt-B reference, and it looks... Okay. I'm not sure I'm interpreting the memos right, and hopefully you can help. But it looks like some of the pool has been run through M3, the prime M3, prime slash alt M3, mm-hmm. and some of the loans in the pool have been run through the older model. But it's not. We'll let's wait till we have the
okay.
document.
Okay, that's fine.
And then let's talk about the development of M3. What was your role in the development, just so I understand what I should be asking you?
It was it flowed. It wasn't very well defined. I had worked on the previous model, so I was to be involved. I worked with David Jai, who is doing the more technical work and the heavy-duty research work. He has his degree was a PhD in financial engineering, and so he was doing the very high-tech analysis. And in part, if there were questions, I would be a resource for him. In part, if he had output, I'd be the first person to look at it and ask him if he had check in which avenues he may or may not have explored.
Yep.
So in a way, a resource as well in terms of being someone who might find things or ask them questions that others might ask. I also took a large role in how the model would look and feel like to the outsiders. He was doing like the calculations, getting them right, and I would work with the programmers on we want the output to show the AAA, the expected loss, the some measure of the geographic concentration, et cetera, the output sorts of measures. Every now and then there were particular areas of research that we could split into two pieces. So he would, so there were times where I do some primary research, like the FICO scores were not in the data set that he was primarily involved in. Hmm. So I did the primary analytic work on the FICO scores. Hmm. I did I'd say the primary analytic work on the mortgage insurance component, although in parallel, we each took developed an approach to the mortgage insurance. And do you want to keep going time-wise? And then
keep going. What else?
And then the economic simulations. I worked on those.
Okay.
This was after he... he left at some point along the process, and I don't know if the economic simulations were the degree to which that work overlapped with his tenure.
On the FICO scores, so as I understand, the main data set for M3 was from loan performance.
Yeah. They may have changed their name, but I think...
Right, it's now part of First American.
Okay, but...
But yes. It's just, you know, the predecessor... Actually, I think the brand name for the data product is still loan performance.
Okay.
At that point, they didn't have FICO scores. I didn't know that. Is that right?
This all happened while the accumulation of the data, acquiring the data, happened while I was not on the team.
Yep.
So I can't answer that, but there was a reason the data set he ended up working with didn't include FICO scores in a way that he found reliable. That's all I know.
Yep.
But
what you said
could be the case.
And then you worked with a separate data set to figure out the FICO score relationships?
Yes.
What was that? What was that data set?
I don't recall.
Was it a loan-level data set?
Yes, it was a loan-level data set.
Okay. And can you describe what the project was, the FICO score project, in more detail? Or what was the goal, and how did you go about
it? Sure. The goal was similar to David's goal and the goal for the predecessor models as well, to see if a relationship could be established between FICO scores and mortgage performance, particularly default risk, because that's where it's most likely to have an impact.
And then how did you go about doing it? What was the approach?
For the FICO now?
For the FICO now, sorry.
It was a statistical analysis. We had loan information, meaning the loan characteristics. Was this loan an 80 LTV and 90 LTV? Was it full doc, no doc, reduced doc? All the loan characteristics, and then whether it was a bad loan or not. Now, that's obviously a vague word, being bad. I don't recall how we define bad for FICO scores. I probably need to spend time on why that's an issue.
Sure,
build
sure,
a model.
Sure,
or,
sure. Yeah.
Okay, but don't want to forget to come back to your original question.
Sure.
When one builds a model, the data is rarely a perfect data set, having everything you would want to know. And what we would want to predict on a pool backing residential mortgage-backed securities is the likelihood of a loan leading to a loss, meaning it gets foreclosed upon, the property is liquidated, and we lose money. Some models can be more accurate if they look at intermediate steps before loss. So it might be that you say these loans are worse because more of them got to 90 days delinquent than others. One thing that might save is, in a rising home price environment, you might have identified a factor that causes borrowers to be unable to pay. But if the rising interest rate and home price environment means there's no loss when you liquidate, a loss model might not say, oh, it's bad to have low FICOs, because look, we haven't lost any money on these low FICO loans. Whereas if you want to anticipate different environments, you might say, use the indication of 90 days late on a payment as showing bad, that these low FICO borrowers are more likely to default in different scenarios. And then, so defining what you mean by bad is one component of developing a model. I don't recall what we define as bad for FICO scores, but we had the loans, loan characteristics, FICO score at loan origination, and whether the loan is good or bad by whatever definition. So then applied a few different, we didn't have a long enough series of those loans to do the same analysis David was doing. He used time series analysis. which is best, gives you the strongest result. You have a long time of history. FICO didn't go back far enough at that, we're now the 2001-ish time frame, although the data probably wasn't so fresh that it was 2001. So it didn't go back long enough, and there was need to do other types of analysis.
And what types of analysis did you do?
I don't recall. I know that I took several approaches. I know linear regression would have been an initial first cut, but we certainly did not go at those results. The end formula, the end formula is not linear, and it proved to be. There are measures to whether your model is doing a good job predicting bads, and nonlinear formulas proved out to be more predictive. FICO themselves, the Fair Isaacs company, which developed its FICO score, measures the strength of FICO score on credit card performance over a two-year window, and that also suggested that FICO wouldn't be a linear measure. So there was support for not using linear. Someone might actually be able to look up the coding and the formula, but I would have to warn on that too. Came up with the formula, we committed it, should we add this formula or not? Actually, there were several alternatives that were committed. Committee agreed on a formula, and then it turned out to be a formula difficult for the computer to incorporate into the other model, but we were able to transpose it into a virtually identical formula using a polynomial that fit the exact same, that fit the shape and was easy for the computer to run. So it's the equivalent of the final formula is embedded in the model, and a mathematician could probably look at that graph and say, oh, this is the same as, you know, whatever the actual formula is.
Right. And so I forget, was it his name David?
Yes.
Doing the other analysis. So he was doing a time series analysis.
Yes.
With a longer history of data.
Yes.
And that involved, was it a hazard model, or do you recall more?
Yes, he referred to it as a hazard model. His mathematics were more sophisticated than what I understood at a granular level. So I could explain basically what a hazard model is, but
no.
Rogers Stein could explain the hazard models.
So it's a little hard for me to understand how David who was estimating this hazard model could then incorporate in that hazard model that would ultimately be implemented in M3 some separate adjustment for FICO based on your analysis.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of an odd operation. Can you talk about sort of how you incorporated from a separate data set some FICO badness loss relationship into this hazard model that was estimated on a different data set? You see why I'm puzzled? It's a little bit of an odd operation.
Well, I don't know why you're puzzled, but okay. I can see that why the question is, yeah, it's a complicated issue.
Yeah.
I'll correct what you said. It actually was more me and others incorporating FICO than it was David taking my result and then baking it back in. But recognizing the strength of the hazard model, I and people I might have committed it with knew that the ultimate answer to be useful would be a model that worked into time series. It turns out FICO is actually a perfect fit for a time series model. I don't know if we got a lot of mileage out of it with the outsiders as to the strength of our approach, but it was certainly worthy of it was a big advance, and it was a good we could do what committee felt was close to a time series analysis by looking at the timing of defaults of the, or badness for the FICO'd loans.
Yep.
And it showed that FICO at origination has a declining predictive power over time. And that may be, think of how it was developed. I mentioned Fair Isaacs developed FICO to predict credit card defaults or maybe late over a two-year window.
Yep.
Okay. The FICO at origination was a strong predictor of bad performance the first year of a loan outstanding. Now, loans don't actually go into foreclosure within a year, so that leads me to suspect, I don't have an independent recollection of it, that bad meant something not quite default. And then it turned out to be less of a predictive element later on. So the fact that someone had a good credit record, good payment history in 1990, strongly predicted their behavior in 1990-91, a little less strong 92-93, and by the time you get out to years 9 and 10, in theory, it would be less predictive. We didn't have the full 10 years.
Yep.
So we had, but we saw the declining trend of the power of FICO in the analysis we did. Again, I don't recall the details or what how a mathematician would describe the research we did. So we could bake that into David's model as having the equivalent of a sliding scale of FICO, a low FICO doubles your risk in year one and increases it by 80% in year two and by 40% in year five and so on. It tied in well with time series, whereas everyone else in the market was simply saying high FICO multiply your default, lowers your default risk by 75% lifetime. We could precisely say it's really predictive here, it's less predictive there. So it was, again, I can't tell you, I don't recall now the mechanics of coming out with that formula, but I think I explained
this
the basis for looking at how it influenced behavior over these time periods and how one could project out a curve for life of a loan.
Did your FICO data set, the data set you used to estimate this FICO loss relationship, did it include low FICO borrowers? Or what was the support of that distribution or the nature of that distribution?
We were because we were building the prime model, we focused on prime. I don't know if there was raw data that we would have excluded from the data set or not, but the final analysis would have been on prime-like FICO scores.
And is there some sort of lower bound FICO score that the model refused to produce an expected loss number, or could it handle a loan all the way down into the 500s? Do you remember?
When I know that a version of Moody's Mortgage Metrics would not run loans with FICOs below a certain level. That may have been a beta or internal version. And I'm sure, I'm not sure when, but I know at some point the question is, if there's just a missing FICO, can we make a conservative assumption and still, and not have the analysts have to go back and find a loan, pull it out, rerun the pool, just, and so there would have been some accommodation for a small number of loans from a mechanical perspective.
Let's talk about the economic simulations.
Okay.
So as I understand it, having read sort of the public documents that are available describing this, M3 used some set, I believe the number was 1,250, doesn't really matter, some number of economic simulations, each of which represented housing prices, unemployment rates, interest rates, anything else? Am I forgetting?
No, those are the
three main.
Yeah, there was state level home price movements. Okay, so there were 1,250, I would call them scenarios. Each scenario has 50 home price paths, one for each state, I'm saying 50. I don't know if we had a Puerto Rico or D.C. kind of state, or if we, but roughly 50. Roughly 50. Did I say home price first? So
yep.
Home price, then unemployment for each state, yep. And a single interest rate vector.
A national interest rate.
Well, you could say that, the Treasury rate.
Yep. Let's just pick one scenario from that distribution.
Okay.
We're now going to, what do we do with that one scenario?
So, well, now you're asking what's in the model and how it develops. So, okay. Yes. What's in the, so in that one scenario, there are 50 or 50-ish home price paths. Each path or vector has 40 cells. It has a home price for the next quarter from after the deal closes, the quarter after, the quarter after, the quarter, et cetera, through 10 years.
Okay.
10 years generally is where we see losses stop occurring on mortgage pools, borrowers who've been able to pay for 10 years, who've built up their, who've reduced their loan balance through amortization over that time. The defaults out to that point in time, after that point in time, tend to be minimal. And of course, in 99% of the economic environments, 10-year home prices will tend to have appreciated as well.
Yeah. So we've got this vector. How does the model use the vector to get a pool loss at that?
Okay. We're going to have to build to what how the model runs. And again, this isn't development now. This is how the model runs. So I take my loan, and just as with the older model publication, I receive a computer file with loan characteristics for that loan. What is the LTV? Was it a full documentation loan or a no documentation loan? Is it a vacation home or owner-occupied, et cetera?
Yep.
David Jai's research would have come up with, I'll call them factors, for the increased hazard risk of those characteristics, or decreased if it's a strong characteristic, like 15-year versus 30. Again, I'll call them factors, but they're actually part of an exponent, so a mathematician might say it's not multiplicative, don't call it factors.
5 by 5.
Okay.
Generally
so
factors.
So there's some...
As an English major would understand.
Okay. So there's a...
thank you.
Generally speaking, a factor linked to each of the loan characteristics.
Yep.
And the model is going to run the calculation. What's the likelihood of that loan defaulting this quarter?
Yep.
What's the likelihood of the loan prepaying this quarter? And what's if it defaults, what's the severity of loss in that quarter? And then it does it for the next quarter and so on and so forth. But within each of these quarterly calculations, aside from the loan characteristics and the associated exponents or factors, there's a look to the economic environment, which has a bearing as well as whether the loan defaults, prepays, and severity of loss on prepay in that quarter. So if my loan happens to be from, where are you from? Virginia?
Originally from Virginia. Yeah.
Okay. So if the loan happens to be from Virginia, mm-hmm. I'm going to look in scenario one, quarter one, at the Virginia home price, unemployment level, and the interest rate, as well as the loan characteristics, and have the model determine the probability of that loan defaulting in quarter one. In addition, just to be complete, to add further predictive power to the model, it turns out that loan behavior isn't just influenced by the home price environment that quarter, but there's a look back period. So look at the home prices that quarter and the home prices going back. I remember the number 3. I can't remember if it's quarters or years, but going back.
Yep.
And so you can see why this model is intense and you can't run it in Excel.
Yes.
That's just for one quarter, for one loan in one of the 1,250 scenarios. That's how the model comes up with loan level information.
So
do you have questions on that?
I do.
Pool?
So,
okay.
Not knowing little about the model, I expected that for that loan, going through this 40 quarter path of, in the economic environment, you would simply update the equity that the homeowner had based on the amortization schedule and the housing price path, and use that equity variable as the way to capture housing prices. But it sounds like that's not what you did. Is that right? Do I understand this correctly?
I may have read that on subprime, but I'm not sure. So talk to Roger about that.
Sure. But I should have clarified. Yeah. This is my a priori guess as to what would be in the model. Yeah. Not based on not read anything that says this, or.
I believe the answer is no. We don't do that. But I'm racking my brain to see if I can say that with certainty or not. I believe it doesn't do that. What you said, that rather it takes the LTV at origination is the number that the computer looks to each quarter in making the calculation. The home price, I also don't recall if the home price number it uses is, I was right for the first quarter, but in the fifth quarter, there's an issue of, does it look to what happened fifth quarter? No, actually, I do know. It looks to fifth quarter and the preceding, like I mentioned, for the shape of the curve, but it also looks at home price movements through origination to fifth quarter.
Is that sort of a separate factor in some sense? There's the... From origination to the quarter you're in?
Like a cumulative.
A cumulative sort of housing price appreciation. And then the how bad housing prices or good housing prices were in that quarter, and some look back window of 3 years or quarters or something.
The look back window is for the shape leading up until that point in time. It's not just it's not repeating the cumulative effect. The look back is. David referred to it as trend and curve. So it was an effort to see like a sustained high unemployment being harsher than unemployment at 8% now and for the preceding three quarters is more stress statistically to a borrower than unemployment that had been 4 and then 6 and then 8. They may have lost their job either way, but they might have had their job longer in the changed environment, for example. So it looked at the shape.
That makes sense on the unemployment. It's a strong intuition. I don't have quite a strong intuition on the housing price side.
Housing price might have gone the other way, but I have no way of knowing that. It might have been that it looked to a sudden rise in home prices not sustainable.
So say that again.
I don't know what the actual formula for the curve, what David called curve and trend, is, but you mentioned that you didn't see an intuitive connection between the shape of how you got your home prices to here and not. And certainly one intuitive connection is a sudden rise in home price intuitively might signal not a less sustainable home price environment.
To me, what that signals is information about the future housing price path, not information about the hazard rate in that quarter. So the hazard rate in that quarter...
But David was looking for a statistical relationship. So it might be he drew a different inference than the one I described to you. But whatever the history showed, it showed you added predictive power if you incorporated the shape leading up to it.
So this is a nice segue.
He could have looked at, do we want to include trend and curve in there? And then there are statistical measures like p-values and t-statistics that help, from a statistical perspective, say this is a meaningful variable that adds predictive power to your model.
Right.
So there is some element, and as I said, I don't know how it came out, but
So it really was driven by the statistics, driven by the statistics on the historical database.
Yes, it was an additional relationship that he found.
Yep.
That I believe other people had not even been looking for, that added predictive strength to the model.
Was there any way to capture whether negative housing price appreciation had a bigger effect on lower quality borrowers? That interaction effect?
There, he looked at interactive factors. I don't know if we saved anywhere a list of which ones were considered. And then, again, it would have been a statistical analysis. Normally, when you do that, you ask the statistics, look at this model just with the factors treated as interactive. Mm-hmm. Look at this model treated interactive and separately, and then look at them just separately, and then reach conclusions as to whether there are interactive factors. And I know he considered interactive factors. I don't know how many are in there. I think it's a small number, though. It's not more than like the total number of factors. You can imagine 10 factors. You could also have 100 different combinations of factors, and it's certainly not of that magnitude. If there are, he may have looked at the 100.
It sounds like, based on the research design, it sounds like he probably didn't look at FICO as an interactive factor, given that that wasn't incorporated into the time series.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. I'm referring to what David looked at as interactive.
Yeah.
Would have been everything he had available economic after his data set, which included the prevailing economy through his the time his loans were outstanding, and the economies immediately preceding those periods.
And so obviously to estimate the effect of negative housing price appreciation on a historical data set, we need some data with negative housing price appreciation, some historical experiences of negative housing price appreciation.
A statistician would disagree with you, actually, on that.
Do tell.
There are... I'm trying to think if there's an easy example or not. What's the highest scoring professional football game, for example? I mean, let's say the highest score in a professional football. I know the Redskins had a Super Bowl 73 as well. Let's say there was an 80. A statistician would look at all of the points ever scored in a game, and they would not say there's no probability of going above 80 just because we never have to date. Not only that, but they would look at how much the points can swing from one game to another and come up with a statistical estimate as to the likelihood of someone scoring 90 points in a football game. Likewise, if I were looking at 10 coin flips, write down how many heads and do that whole experiment 20 times. Odds are you've never flipped 9 heads. It's about 1 in 100 times you get 9 out of 10 heads. But I could use the statistics and how often and how far off of 5 you've moved in your 20 trials to tell you that probably every 100 times or so you'll get 9 heads. So I don't have to have included an environment in the historical data set to be able to have statistically predict that environment happening and the likelihood of it happening.
Sure, let me clarify. What I meant was not creating the likelihood of that environment, but rather the causal effect of that environment on mortgage performance. So let's talk about negative housing price appreciation as taking the red pill. We've got a pill. It's red. We want to know what it does to people. You can't, as a statistician, figure out what taking the red pill does to people if you don't have some people taking red pills. You see what I'm saying?
I guess the pill example breaks down then. The mortgage behavior isn't like the pill example because it's not a yes, no, have they taken the red pill or haven't they taken the red pill. If you see a difference in performance in an 8% rising real estate environment versus weaker performance in a 2% rising rate environment, a statistician will give you some metric as to, based on the difference in behavior I've observed between the 8 and the 2, then statistically I'm going to project this behavior when it goes from 2 to negative 2. Now, different statisticians would probably come up with different answers. Coin flips, they wouldn't, because that's a mechanical process. Statisticians would all agree on the probability if you looked at coin flips, or if you didn't know if it was a fair coin or not, they'd still agree if they knew it was a coin. Predicting human behavior is far more complicated than that, and has more variability than that, more uncertainty than that. But statisticians will tell you, based on here are the parameters I used, here's the way I approached the data, and then even tell you if they feel their prediction is robust or not. They can measure how comfortable they are saying, since I've observed between 8 and 2, I feel comfortable projecting between 16 and negative 10. So statisticians do that. So it doesn't mean everyone's going to agree with the statisticians.
So this is very helpful. So help me understand how Moody's thought about this problem in the context of M3. So you had some set of historical data that included various types of housing price appreciation, some at whatever, 8, some at 2, maybe some at negative 2, I'm not sure. Tell me, how did that work in practice? How did that estimation work?
Okay. It was, I recall it more in broad terms than in specifics at this point. It would have been either agreed or disagreed in committee that the linkages that David found would prove robust outside of his historical range of economic environment. So questions would be, a lot of the people might get comfort from their own experiences outside of the mortgage market or outside of periods for which we have precise loan-by-loan data, but still knowing what happened pool-wise in Texas and nationwide to some degree during the other stress periods. It would have been agreed that the linkages he found would apply through harsher economic environments than has been observed. And then it also would have come to simulate the economic environments. We have this linkage between loan performance and the economy. The old model said, convert that to a mean and a variance, and then based on historical variability, say, this many standard deviations that's a log normal curve, but this many standard deviations has such and such a probability of occurring. Here it was far more sophisticated. It was saying, go as bad as you want with the economy, and the model factors will give you the model predicted output.
Yeah. This is a much easier to understand approach than the earlier one for me, actually.
Oh, okay. That's a lot of people, I guess it depends. If people have taken a statistics course, they might think they know the bell curve, and maybe it's because they don't necessarily challenge the curve or not, but if mathematically in coin flips, three standard deviations means 0.5% of the time you're going to be above that number. That might be very tangible to people, as opposed to this one. I can't give you one numerical relationship. Here's our stress case. Here's the result. Here's the likelihood. But I think it's a better way to include economic stresses in your analysis, because you're directly stressing the economics, and you could go back as to whatever period you felt the data was reliable on the underlying economy.
Yep.
Even if you didn't have loan performance information through that period, you can project the home prices using 1970s data if you want to.
So let's talk about that. How did they come up with the distribution for those 1,250 economic scenarios?
Okay. Do you want to ask the question that broadly? I mean, this can be, that would be a long answer.
Let's go into it. Yeah, I want the lengthy answer.
Okay. And again, I wish this were I wish this were 10 years, well, 8 years ago. All right. So I'm taking it as a given that we understand the need for projecting home prices each quarter over a 10-year window for each state. We also don't want to simply project one scenario. We don't say, here's Moody's best estimate of home prices over the next 10 years in each state and unemployment over the next 10 years. I mean, that might be one helpful thing for the market to hear, but that alone won't tell me how much credit support do I need to for a AAA security, to for a security that's going to withstand certain degrees of stress, and how much do I need for BAA and so on. What's needed is to generate a range of economic environments so that you can look at the overall range of environments and say, okay, you've captured expected cases better than expected, slightly worse than expected, quite a bit worse than expected, yeah, extremely worse than expected.
Yeah.
That's a necessary element. A lot of the literature on making economic projections refers to the best way to make a single path projection. To get the range of projections, we need to add some variability to the best guess. And there are ways to measure historically what the variability can be off of the metrics. So unemployment probably was, start with a national unemployment number, take historical data on that. There'd have to be agreement on what time set you're looking at. If the depression occurred, is that number relevant, or are we in a different world now? You have the government change, that's the internationalization, whatever it is. So that would have been discussed and decided. I don't recall exactly what data set we use for unemployment. Then there are linkages between, and this is one of the things that makes it different than coin flips. There are linkages between the national unemployment rate and unemployment in each of the states. Some states are actually more representative of national than others, and the linkage is even tighter. Some tend to go their own way a little more.
Yeah.
You know, like for, I mentioned the oil patch, so those states tended to move not exactly like the national. You know, oil was doing well, they were doing well. If oil was employed, they were doing poorly.
Yep.
One needs to get the link for each state that you're trying to model. You can develop a linkage, like a correlation between the national and that state. That would be based on historical observation. Historically, the state moved exactly like the United States. Historically, the state moved exactly opposite, and so on, and any range in between. Then you'd consider other inputs. Do I consider the unemployment rate a quarter before, 2 quarters before, a year before? You'd want to know whether that had an influence. And then you may want to consider the linkage of that state to other states. Illinois and Indiana tend to move together because of geographic proximity, et cetera. So that would be an element to doing it. The last element is, mathematicians call it an error term. I don't really think it's something that crept in, and we didn't want it there. I'm using the word error term in its mathematical sense for the record. The error term is a measure of the variability of the prediction versus actual. And using the error term and stressing the error term is what turns the core calculation of a prediction of unemployment paths into a range of predictions. The error term needs to be discussed at Moody's in committee, or you know, agreed upon by whoever's doing the modeling. And you can look historically at what the error term would be versus your prediction. So here's my best prediction. Here's what happened. Oh, look, if I look at how far off I was, it looks like a bell curve. Or it looks like this figure four, this log normal distribution. Right? So you'd look at the, you'd analyze the distribution of the error term historically, and then agree, all right, when I make my projections, I'll use a normal distribution. You could also, from historical comparison of your formula prediction to actual, come up with the variability, a standard deviation of the error term as well. Mm-hmm. So you can say it's normal, and here's the mean of the average error term, here's the standard deviation of the error term. And that's one way to project the economy. Along the way, you'd probably ask and then approve or reject certain linkages. You know, is it a better prediction if I show the correlation to five different states or just one key state? How much weight do I give to the U.S. versus the preceding in the particular state?
And this is all specific to what you've been describing as the analysis of the unemployment part of this factor.
Yes, I've been describing it for unemployment, although it's going to be similar.
Okay.
Is that the level of depth?
This is great. Please.
Okay, so that's how one would do it. If you're tying back to the Moody's process, all these results would be committed. It doesn't mean that everyone would go through the process on their own and say, oh, we all got the same answer. In fact, probably wouldn't. But it would be just like in a rating committee. The analyst would present a recommendation, say, here are alternatives, here are the supporting statistics. And, you know, are we comfortable with the primary recommendation, or are we comfortable with the alternatives, or start over again?
So a similar, for housing prices, a similar procedure to the one you described for unemployment, you know, roughly analogous, was employed?
I think so. I don't know if national home price, well, it would have been considered. I don't know if that was kept as a starting point for the environments, or if it was found not to be helpful to start with a national home price projection. National is, historically, national movements were very constrained, right? The national home price movements until recently, while we were developing this model, had not shown declines. Individual states very much had shown declines. So that may have been one element in considering starting with national home price, that it may have looked too muted using that. So I don't have the memos or recollection of
course.
But it would have, so I guess I should talk more about correlation, and some of this we'll look back and apply to unemployment. I just left.
Okay.
I guess I didn't cover every little piece. Right. So we have these home price projections. California is by far the most important state for the jumbo market. Most pools had between 40 and 60% California concentration. So there was some emphasis placed on getting California closest to historical, and then whatever other adjustments we'd need to make on the other states to get, say, correlation right, we would make those adjustments on the other states' numbers. So we'd end up with the correlations are correct like we want, and California is as close to historical as possible.
Yeah.
The other states were also as close as possible, but provided that we had to bake in these other elements that were equally important, like correlation. So the manual process, if you want this detail, would have been start with California, project it out the 40 quarters, 1,250 times using the formula. The formula meaning preceding home price movements, the error term.
So you take a draw from your error term distribution, and basically that determines the, is it a single draw, or is it probably multiple draws of an error term distribution?
Each cell involved looking at the preceding quarter or two or three, I don't remember how many,
okay.
whatever linked numbers there might have been, like there's a link to interest rate or unemployment, might have had an influence on California's home price movement.
Yeah.
And the draw on the error term.
I see.
Then the next quarter comes along. You've already projected the first quarter, so that would now be the, instead of the historical quarter preceding your simulation, you would take the quarter preceding quarter two as your projected quarter one.
Yep.
So you take where you started with quarter one, if unemployment was relevant, then you'd take unemployment. If another state was relevant, take another state, and draw on the error term, and so on, and you go out 40 quarters.
And so there's some degree of autocorrelation in this process.
Yes.
You're looking back yesterday's quarter, and this is also the three elements, unemployment, housing prices, interest rates, are related in a modeled way so that you're getting sort of a consistent scenario, not just sort of random house prices on one hand, random unemployment on the other.
Right, where we found the link.
Yeah.
I don't know if we looked to see if there's a link between all three, and economists talk about a link for all three that's worthwhile to independently model. I don't recall if we established in committee that there was a link for all three, or if we got better projections not taking a link into account directly. But if interest rates drive unemployment and then unemployment is used in home price, there's a question, do I use interest rates again, or the fact that it's embedded in unemployment is a better way to do it than to do it directly. So again, I'm not saying if you look for it, you'll find all three in the final product, but it would have been considered, and it may be in there indirectly, which we could look into.
So obviously this model was used over some time period in which...
Sorry, Ryan, but the committee I didn't end because I guess I didn't cover the committee process.
Okay.
So as with unemployment, the committee's not going to look at each cell and the underlying calculations. They could, but but the first cut would be look at statistics. So you'd look at, okay, here are your home price projections. You know, are you showing the right things? Are you showing stress environments? Yep. You know, those are obvious questions that would come up in approving a the simulation. So that gets me to the point of what we did through model development. Implementing and programming is, I'll comment on separately.
Okay.
But if
I was,
let me go back to your question.
Yeah, one more question on the understanding how this economic scenario was implemented.
Well, you said not implemented. This is developed.
I'm sorry.
Right?
Let me use better words.
Because we're going to implement it.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean implement. I mean, here we go. We've got a pool of loans, and we want to use the model to predict its loss distribution.
Okay.
Let's say the pool of loans, say this pool is being rated in first quarter 2004. And then let's take another pool of loans, and it's being rated in second quarter 2005, some other period. Did the model take into account the actual state of the economy, the real economy, not the model world, the real economy when those pools are being rated to project out, or was it a stationary distribution?
Moody's mortgage metrics, maybe I don't know what you meant by stationary distribution, but I can answer your question.
Okay.
Moody's mortgage metrics was updated every quarter. So if you were it was available to subscribers, maybe not at beta and all that, but it at some point became available to subscribers. It was updated every quarter. You got a new CD every quarter because of the autocorrelation. For people, autocorrelation means the result in one period is related to the same measure in a period before.
These guys
for the record.
Care. These guys don't care.
They don't care, and the record people might want to know. Because of the autocorrelation, you want to know where you are now, and that would supersede where you might have thought 3 months ago you would have been now.
Yep.
So where you are today and price on periods before today influences the economic projections, and you would get a new CD every quarter.
So,
and we internally, of course, would run with the updated model too.
Right. So, one way to characterize the price, home price appreciation through or 2001 through 2006, and then the subsequent home price depreciation that has occurred since 2006, is we had an asset bubble, like what economists call an asset bubble, which is where the price of the asset is getting out of whack from fundamentals. It's higher than the supply and demand in the housing market for building new homes would predict housing prices to be. People are investing these homes in expectation of future price appreciation, and you can get an equilibrium in which prices go up, 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 but it's unsustainable. Ultimately, expectations change and they crash. This is one account of the housing crisis. Was there any way for the model approach you described to the approach of choosing this distribution of economic scenarios to take into account the notion that, say, in 2005, we may be in the midst of a bubble? So, for example, if I were, I'm thinking intuitively, I would think, we might want to put in more negative error terms. It's probably not the way you'd implement it, but you'd want to have more weight put on negative home price appreciation vectors, given that we actually think Moody's, Moody's has people that think about the housing market, Moody's thinks we might be in the midst of a bubble. Was that done at all, or can you, does this make sense, how I'm explaining it, and how was that sort of issue dealt with?
There's a lot there. You're referring to other people referring to it as an asset bubble. That was 99% of those people after it happened and the decline look back on it and says, this looks to me like an asset bubble. During the appreciation, that wasn't the majority view out there, but it, the increase was above historical long-term norms. There always questions, is it a paradigm shift? Is the government pushing for home ownership? You can imagine what a paradigm shift might be, but the government certainly talked about hoping to have home ownership be higher than historical levels. And in hindsight, people look at the up and the down, say it was an asset bubble. Through 2006, when I left in 2006, few were saying, here's the appreciation, and it's definitely a bubble. Moody's, I might not be the right person for part of the question. Moody's had a macroeconomist, John Lonsky. He would help inform our decisions on macroeconomic issues.
Was he involved in the process by which M3's simulations were updated quarterly?
No.
Okay, not that level.
No. I or other people in the committee may have asked him one-off questions as, you're an expert in economics. I don't think got as deep. No, I don't think people would have gone so detailed. Say, do you think a normal distribution is best for the error term? But they might have asked more, more broad questions about it.
Could you spell his last name just so?
I believe it's L O N S K I.
Great.
So I commented on the bubble part. So John Lonsky with the macroeconomics person. Yeah. I don't want to speculate what would have happened if, like John Lonsky said, this is a real estate bubble, and that's Moody's position. I think it's obvious from what we would do with that information. But
that wasn't said, just to make sure I understand. This was not Moody's did not view this as an asset bubble or housing bubble.
The Moody's position was that there was not during the time frame that where I was involved in the issue was not a national, we're not in a national housing bubble.
And so in these quarterly updates to the economic simulation through 2004, 2005. Moody's did not adjust them because they were concerned it would be an asset, that we were in a housing bubble. Or how did, did this come up in the community?
Whatever was automated in the model as to the lookbacks and the curve and the trend continued to be used. And I don't know specifically if the particular environment led any of those metrics to have an impact, such as you're describing or not.
And the committees, to your knowledge, didn't adjust what the model was doing in order to sort of hard code some concern about a bubble into it's sort of the mechanics of the. So you I just want to make sure I understand the committee process, because you described that this would be reviewed. Was it reviewed every quarter by a committee, or is that? I'm not actually making sense of that.
The economic updates became mechanical, so I think it was done by a group of people. It was not. I think it was not committed with analysts, but rather committed with the quant and modeling team at that point. So it was committed.
But by quant people.
Yeah.
No. This has been incredibly helpful. I now understand this much, much better. And then, can you help me understand the general character of the distribution of home prices in particular that came out of this 1,250 scenarios? And I know it's complicated because it's actually 50 different states in each of those scenarios. All I know at this point is what you told me today, and I believe I read in one of Moody's documents, I'm not sure which, it was probably one of the M3 sort of announcing M3 documents, that on average in the model, home prices trend up 4% annually. But, you know, of course, that would incorporate years in which they would, you know, deviate from 4%. But because
and I think that was national, too, right?
That's right.
Because you said each state had its own, states showed slightly different numbers in some cases.
So maybe let me make this a more precise question just so I'm clear. Like, if you calculated a national housing price index out of the home price vector for a given scenario, and we looked at a distribution of sort of 1 year housing price appreciations in each of those scenarios across the scenarios, how many of those would be negative? We know the mean is 4%.
I don't know how many were negative. Yeah. When we committed the distribution, there was data to that effect. I don't know if it was necessarily national the way you described or state level, because we ran the model state level, that was more important, although it would have been interesting to see the national. I don't know if we used a 1 year window as our important basis for the comparison, so I don't know which metrics we used, and I certainly don't recall the actual metrics now. I got the committee comfortable as to the depth of the home price declines in the development data set.
Would there be a document that was prepared for the committee by you or whomever was responsible for the modeling of the economic scenarios that would provide some information to the committee about these overall statistics or shapes of the distribution?
Sure.
Do you remember preparing that? Did you prepare that document?
Well, again, it's as to the metrics that I was describing, which I'm just want to be clear, might not match the one you first asked about. Like I said, it might not be, you know, the 1 year national, but whatever numbers were
used
to get people comfortable. I was the one who would have prepared that document.
And if we got that document, that would probably help me understand better the distributions, the guts of this machine. I think that would be useful for me to look at, or?
I think I described what it said, but if you...
I think it would be useful, based on what you said. Are there any other documents you think would be useful for me to understand the guts of this machine? What would you recommend?
I mean, I don't even know if that document still exists,
yeah,
but we're
we'll
talking if we have it.
No, we'll find out. Yeah. It's a separate task.
And what's the best description of that document?
That's a great question.
Right.
The numbers would have been Excel spreadsheets, and there might have been... If there was text, it would have been a page of explanation.
Okay.
It was mostly committing the economic simulations, we were committing just the economic simulations. There was some point later where we integrated things, but so it was highly quantitative, and would have been.
So if I were going to ask people who are currently at Moody's to find this document, what would I call it? Well, how would I describe it to them?
Oh boy.
And where would it be?
Because Steve's going to have to look through every hard drive until he finds it.
And I'm not sure I even know.
Well, so just think about World Day weekend. Just think about
it. Do you have the computer I used in 2001?
Is that where it would be?
That's where it would be. It would be on the computer I used in 2001.
Who was on the committee, actually? That would be helpful, too.
I don't recall exactly who was on.
Like, who in general would be, sort of titles, or, like, what is it, how did they, in general, form these sorts of committees to review models?
Andy Silver was on many of the modeling committees, but I don't know if it was that one or not.
Sure.
S-I-L-V-E-R.
Who else?
I don't know who else was on them. He had a team of like a quantitative analytics team. This was also probably happening before I rotated back.
I see.
So I'm not trying to, not knowing the people in the structured finance analytics team. It's not because I'm being evasive.
No.
It's that I wasn't on the team, and he was drawing people in.
The committee, I think I misunderstood. It's not that the committee that reviewed the economic simulations that was convened before you got back. That was after you got back.
No. It was before I started work on the. Did this not get asked? I started work on the model, and overseeing David Jai before I rotated back.
I misunderstood that. I see.
Did I not?
No, you said that.
Okay.
I just missed it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. I see. So you were working on this prior to rotating back.
Yes.
This makes total sense. Great.
Are we close to a point for another maybe 5-minute break?
Close. Let me finish up on the economic simulations.
Sure.
So we have this sort of complete. So what other documents would help me understand the guts of M3? What are the sorts of things that you think I should read if I want to get an understanding of?
I don't want to use the words. When they developed the next model, that was a person who developed that, Roger Stein, is an expert in building models.
Yep.
And I discovered that my documentation skills were deficient relative to the standard that people use when they develop models. So
okay.
He was asking historically about, we would spend time and he would ask historically about this part of the model, that part of the model. He had the coding, but as I said before, between development and implementation, there were other steps as well.
Sure.
So he's looking at a post-implementation sort of model, and sometimes he wanted to know about the development, such as you're asking, how did you simulate? And it's really, so there is not the traditional specs kind of document that one would, that he says someone who in his job would have. It's largely my recollection, and I'm trying to, I didn't realize this would come up, you know, 10 years after the fact. So my recollection and the spreadsheets I would have used in committee.
We actually experienced, obviously, sustained period of housing price depreciation nationally over the last several years.
And the spreadsheets being on my computer just to make saying the last step of what I was implying. That's where the data information was.
We will be looking far and wide for that machine. So we experienced negative housing price depreciation, negative housing price appreciation nationally over the last several years. What is your sense for the probability of that occurring as measured by the distribution used in M3? Was it even within the support of that distribution? Or was this off to the left-hand side and assigned no probability?
You mean the right-hand side, because you refer to it looking on? You mean overhearing?
This is for the housing price distribution. So we'll make negative to the left.
Oh, I see.
Was this off to the left-hand side?
Now I understand your question.
Okay, good.
But I don't know the answer to that question.
What is your best guess?
I don't have a guess. We didn't run that information. We considered when we published the report, whether to show some raw data and scenarios and examples, and didn't. So we didn't.
So I have a guess. I guess it's zero. What do you know that should make me think it's not zero?
Okay, you asked the question probability, which implied that I could go to like tiny, tiny fractions, et cetera. Let's see. Are you guessing zero probability, or are you guessing
correct.
Zero weight in among the 1,250?
Let me put it this way. Here's my guess. My guess is that in the history of rating RMBS using this model, of the 1,250 draws for each of those ratings, not one draw had as negative a housing price appreciation nationally as we've experienced over the last 3 years. Do you agree? And what can you tell me that should move me from that guess, educated guess, I'll even call it, if you will.
I'd have to get more information. I could check as to if you tell me what the pool predicted default frequencies were versus what we've experienced, and if we always see a gap, then it's fair to say that either the underlying factors were wrong or the economic stress cases were not as stressful as this environment. So from that information, we could conclude one or the other.
But based on your understanding of the way just the economic simulations were designed, you think there's a possibility that there are some runs that were used to rate deals that incorporated the housing price appreciation we've actually experienced over the last 3 years?
No, I'm not saying I think there are, but I want to get some of these numbers before I answer.
Okay. I would love to know if you can do some background work. We'd love to. This is obviously of great interest.
I mean, that wouldn't be something I personally can. I don't work at Moody's. I can't do that.
You were the one who designed these things, which is why you're the key person to ask this question to. I suppose we could go your route, which is to get all of the analysis that were done in every deal. But I thought you might be willing to give us some sense for why it could possibly be not zero. Because I'm going to walk out of this room still thinking it's zero, unless you can give me some reason to believe otherwise. I mean this sincerely. I'm not trying to play a game, it's my sincere belief.
I'm trying to think if I remember enough now to roll. I told you it would be one of, if your scenario is right, and what I've read suggests it is right, that there are losses exceeding the AAA credit support.
Oh, yes.
And a number of the deals that were run through M3. I think you're implying while I was at Moody's, so even including 2005, or because I haven't seen.
No, I mean 2006, 2007, 2008. Let's say, or actually, let's say from 2006 to 2009.
All right. So you're asking, as a developer, my best guess on pools that I hadn't seen.
So let me. I'm being very unclear. Let me back up. The 2006, 2009. We're going to use that period to establish a housing price factor. That is literally what in our economy experience from 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009. It turns out it was something like negative 38% nationally.
Over a very short time window.
That's right.
And
so what I want to know is, let's say in while you were at Moody's from 2005 to 2006, for all of those RMBS that were rated, based on your understanding for how the economic simulations, your intimate understanding, you're the best educated person in the world on this question, really. 2005 through 2006, while you were there, were any of those 1,250 draws per deal, for every deal, did any of those incorporate as severe a decline in housing prices as we actually experienced in the period from 2006 to 2009? My guess, as I said, is no, not a single one of those thousands, maybe even millions of draws of the economic simulation incorporated anything like what we actually experienced. And I don't walk out of this room thinking that unless you can give me some reason to believe otherwise based on your understanding of the design of the engine that generated the probability.
Right. Probably with that number of cells, we had some cells that were 5 standard deviations off. And I recall that there was something about Excel that would generate that as if you asked it for enough random variables, you'd get a few that were 5 standard deviations. So it was a 30% drop. Statistically, my opinion on the statistics is that what we've seen, the environment we've seen, would have been more than that drop using the statistics that we used. But I can't say as to, the first-hand knowledge of any of these pools after I left, nor as to what contributed to the loss numbers in relation to the factors and the economic environment.
Those are all separate.
But to the extent of the statistics.
Let me just make sure I understood the two. You had a drop in that. You had two different variables here. Your statement was that the housing price drop we actually experienced from 2006 to 2009, which is something north of 30%, was greater than the 5 standard deviation worst drop in the simulation of an M3.
My statistical opinion is, I'm saying I don't know from looking at the numbers, and you're mixing up a little bit, like the cell by cell versus like some overall 38% is an overall national number. So there may have been components of this real estate drop that the statistics would have covered, but the 38% national drop, staying down over this short but multiple year period, is more stressful than the statistics call for.
Great, this is incredibly helpful. We want to take a 5-minute break now.
Yeah.
You got it. 5 minutes to 1 o'clock. We'll go off record.
Okay.
I have 1:05 back on record. Mr. Ross, no substantive discussions while we were off.
Right.
All right.
We did discuss your charity. Put that on the record. Great work. So I just want to go. I've got a list of items I want to make sure I cover and get some basic understanding of. And then we can talk about some ratings memos, and then you can help me sort of understand what the ratings memos are saying. In fact, I think I might even have one that you were on the committee for, which will be fun.
Mm-hmm.
So do you can you give me some sense for how far back the M3, the data set on which M3 was based, goes?
On which the economic simulation?
No, I'm sorry. The mortgage.
The mortgage?
That data set.
At this point, I don't remember the FICO data set. I do recall we had to project out the later years, so it definitely was not 10 years long, and it probably wasn't more than 6. Just thinking through the effort to make the projection. The underlying data set that David Jai used, I don't know.
Why wasn't the M3 model adopted for subprime at this point? I know it's just to clarify. I know it was ultimately a new M3 for subprime. Presumably subprime mm-hmm. was developed and released in sometime in 06 or 07, but back then, why wasn't it adopted?
Yeah. There are a few reasons why a subprime model is different than a prime model. Why you would not just blend all loans together and do your analysis, prime, alta, and subprime. Say, here's my data set. Well, look, these subprime ones are worse. That's what the model is supposed to show.
Right.
And it gives me a full impact of LTV and FICO and all that. The market's developed in practice to have different underwriting and servicing standards. So they're even when loan characteristics were reported, and you might think, oh, I'm comparing an 80 LTV prime loan to an 80 LTV subprime loan, I can just back up the subprime element and use the same core model.
Yep.
Prime originations in practice generally had better appraisal standards. So it wouldn't be apples to apples to say 80 LTV is my model input. Computer, tell me the impact of being an 80 LTV. Because the computer would say the data would show 80 LTV looks predictive safe on prime and unsafe on subprime and doesn't know how to weight the LTV.
Yep.
So largely because of different origination practices, servicing too, when you would start initiate foreclosure on subprime. Prime borrowers, traditionally, if they were late a month or even two, that was viewed as a cause for a letter and eventual follow-up, and you'll probably get paid back. In subprime, being 2 weeks late was a visit. There's just much more concern that any missed payment was a signal of ultimate default for subprime, whereas generally speaking, for prime, a two-week delay when someone's on vacation, they forgot to mail the check. It's not true in absolute terms. That's how the market developed. So so defining a bad would probably be different subprime and prime. So, and I could probably name others. There are a lot of differences and well-documented between the prime and subprime markets. So they weren't apples-to-apples loans.
Why not create a separate tool at that point for subprime?
The issue was I wasn't on the team when they decided to develop the model,
okay.
So I'm not the right person. I don't know if they had the data or not to do both, if data was available for both.
Were there any other issues that you think might have influenced that decision?
I wasn't there. I'm really not the right person to ask. I wasn't on the mortgage team when they decided to pursue updating the older model.
So when you came back and the M3 was officially launched for Alt-A and prime pools.
You keep throwing in Alt-A, but it really was Alt-A in and of itself doesn't have a tremendous lot of meaning. What's now known as the Alt-A market means different things depending on who the originator is.
Yep.
It's not, we're not talking bank accounting where every bank reports real estate owned exactly the same way in delinquencies. It's an unregulated market.
Just to clarify, I'm using your language. That is, not your personally, but in your document, I read these documents, when you announced M3, it was explicitly for prime jumbo and all-day pools. Your terminology.
That was back then. But
it was in 2003, just to clarify.
Okay. The report came out in 2003, but the all-day market has continually been evolving.
Yep.
So I am okay with what we wrote, that Alt-A back then was run through that model. But I'm not commenting on after I left what Alt-A, even before I left, as Alt-A was evolving, that we would take every Alt-A pool and be able to run it through M3.
So I'm still confused. How would you figure out whether a pool could go through M3 or not? You're rating all these RMBS of different kinds. Mm-hmm. As you suggest, these definitions like Alt-A aren't exactly self-evident.
Prime was self-evident, subprime was, and Alt-A occupied the space in between. One would look at loan characteristics.
Yeah.
Ultimately, the best way is for the analyst to take both models to committee and see where the result is, and eventually they'd say, this type of pool, the committee is not taking the M3 result, or the committee is taking the M3 result.
I presume the M3 result, since it was a prime model, it would generally be higher than the 1996 tool as it had been evolved as an alternative way to rate subprimes. Is that right?
I don't understand.
Sorry,
the question.
I'm not being clear. the M3 would predict better loan performance than the 1996 tool would.
On what type of pool?
On these marginal pools, let's say. These pools where it's not clear.
I don't know.
Okay. You don't know?
If I understand you right, I don't know, or I might not understand.
So
the
question is, if we took a pool that the analyst was uncertain whether it belonged in the M3 bucket or the 1996 tool, as an updated for which we lack a name bucket, and ran them through both. When that happened, would the M3 model typically predict lower expected losses on the mortgage pool than the 96 pool?
I don't recall, and I don't even recall if there was a general rule that it was always one way or the other.
Yeah. And the 96 tool then was continued as it was updated over time, was still being used for the subprime pools at this point.
It was still a tool in committee, yeah.
When did it stop being used, the 96 base tool?
It was being used when I left.
It was being used when I left. I see.
With other tools as well.
For sure. Yeah. And you said subprime pools were self-evident. How did you figure out whether it was a subprime pool? You use some sense.
Later in my career, it was FICO scores, FICO is an indicator of borrower quality. Early in my career, lenders would put risk grades on borrower quality. Usually it was A, B, C, sometimes A minus, and then sometimes it got more confusing. There would be gold, silver, platinum program. Anything with an EZ in it, with the Z as a letter instead of EZ spelled out, it's subprime. But it was mainly based on the borrower's historical credit record, not reflected in a FICO score, but just they've been late on a mortgage payment once in the last year, what might be a B, and three times in the last 2 years might be a D, but it varied by originator, no standardization again. That's just an example of how they might come graded.
Later in your career, when FICO scores were used, how do you figure out from FICO scores whether it's subprime? Can you give us more detail on how that works?
I don't remember the cutoff, but it was generally self-evident.
So there was some cutoff.
I don't even know. There might be a loan where it was one side or the other of the cutoff, but it was part of the origination process. Was all the other loans are subprime, so it wouldn't be based strictly. The cutoff wasn't strict.
And would a pool as a whole get categorized as subprime, or would loans, individual loans?
Usually they were put together so that the whole pool was subprime or not, but could someone have sent us a pool drawn from, people could have done whatever they wanted to create a pool.
And were there certain originators that almost always were considered subprime?
Yes.
The easy originators.
Yes.
Or quick with just a K.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So how were the originators factored into M3? More precise. Did M3 provide adjustments based on the originator the effect loss?
Yeah, I remember the topic and the considerations and not the outcome. Would that help you?
Please, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. The there was still this historical factor quantification of what we thought of the originator from the old approach. But because M3 was being sold to the public, there was an issue whether we should embed the originator factor into the model and thus let everyone know, like competitors, what we thought about other originators.
Right.
So that was the issue. And I don't know if the result was the Moody's internal version would have it embedded and the external version would not, or if the resolution was to just not include it within the model and for the analyst to adjust.
But either way, the analyst did ultimately get an adjusted expected loss incorporating the originator factors, whether it was embedded in the model
I'd like to see the report, but I'm sure we did. Originator and servicer were, at some point we had a discrete servicer quality rating, and then at some point that started to be translated into a quantitative impact on the pools. So I don't recall specifically the overall mix and the timeline of when we used originator, when we used servicer, when we split them, whether one replaced the other.
Let's see. How different were the M3 outputs from the 96 outputs for pools that Moody's considered appropriate for M3? So in this transition period, you can imagine running through both models.
Yeah.
What do they look like?
Yeah. There was I mentioned earlier, I don't know if I need to repeat. So I mentioned earlier that the FICO research had been baked in before we rolled out M3.
Yep.
So absent that, when I came back, the pools were very strong. The FICOs were stronger than historical average, even though Moody's didn't bake in FICO. We knew we would get information on FICOs in pools. So we knew the FICOs were strong, and the FICO adjustments, on average, reflected the pools being stronger than we otherwise knew. So you asked about it as in terms of levels, I think.
Yeah,
so in terms of levels, in terms of loss expectations, the loss expectations were lower with the FICO included than without the FICO included for pools that had FICO better than historical average, which at that time period was most of the pools.
But the 96 pool.
So then when M3 was rolled out, which was your question, I don't recall there being a material difference between the M3 output and the now including FICO old model sorts of outputs in a broad directional sense. But there were certain pools that were up, certain pools that were down. And in fact, part of the, during the internal use of M3, the internal rollout, committees would made more adjustments than later on. Eventually, like committees might have input, and we'd realize, oh, you know what, M3 isn't quite being harsh enough or loose enough on this feature or that factor. Instead of having the analysts always go to committee and saying, here's M3, here are all the complicated reasons we want to add. Plus, we're going to add 20 for factor X. Eventually, you just bake factor X into the model. So by the time it was rolled out to the public, and you're saying 2003 is a publication date, so I'll assume that was the right date for the public rollout, it had already been used internally, tweaked to take into account. Sometimes the analyst would say, well, the model's saying the benefit or penalty for this should be 20 beats. We always used to use 10. And we'd say, well, the model's, here's what the model did. Why do you think it's 10? And the model would be right. Sometimes the other way around. It's like, well, statistics say 20. And they say, well, we know this. We've seen this one for a stress, or we've seen it. So sometimes the analysts were committed as being more right, and the model has changed. Sometimes the raw model output was deemed to be right, and the analysts learned to accept that.
And the M3 model was publicly available, is that right, that you said?
Yes, again, there was some time period where it was, we used it internally, and then there, I'll say I'm sure that we had some beta use, some beta input outside. Yeah. I know we talked about that, I'm pretty darn sure we did that. And then it became available.
Now maybe we can just talk through a couple ratings memoranda, not all of which, I think most of which, I appreciate you were not on these committees, but I'm sure you've seen many a ratings memorandum in your career at Moody's, mm-hmm. and maybe you can just give us, from your understanding of how committees work in general and the process works in general, help me to interpret these documents, because it's to an outsider.
Were these while I was on the structured finance team?
In some cases, yes. So I think this one is, so this is a rating committee memorandum from April 2006 for the pool Argent 2006 W5.
Right, so this was after I left Moody's.
This is right around the time you left.
Yeah, it's after I left.
So you left in April 2006?
Yes, I left in the beginning of April 2006.
And this is the end of April 2006?
Yes.
Great. Okay. Oh, yep, sorry. The rate number is Moody's FCIC 8739. So, first, under the note, it talks mm-hmm. about giving the Alt-B benefit.
Mm-hmm.
What is the Alt-B benefit?
We published a report, and in this case, again, I'm not saying everyone in the market called Alt-B the same thing and used it all the same way, but this is shorthand for Ameriquest is a subprime originator, and I mentioned the difference in origination and servicing practices between subprime and prime. You recall the appraisal standards being weaker and, right. and so on and so forth. At some point, the subprime originators started originating loans using the tighter origination standards that one might ordinarily see in an Alt-A or even prime pool. So in this case, one example that I see from this memo, but I was not there, is that loans get 2 months reserves. Certain loans get 2 months of reserves from the underwriting guidelines, meaning that they check that the borrower had cash on hand after the loan closed. That was typical in the prime. If you talk to a prime borrower who's gone through the process of taking out a mortgage loan, they would have asked for that. In subprime, historically, they would not have asked for that. So the weak historical performance of subprime is partly attributable to lack of reserves. If they changed their underwriting standards and got reserves, then we had published on, and then I believe quantified at some point. It may have been judgmental at first, quantified a benefit for giving reserve, for underwriting this stronger way, in this case getting reserves. And so I'm sure committee would have asked about other, I'm speculating, but knowing the committee process, they would have inquired beyond this one sentence about the originating process and decided would benefit, if any, to give for the tightened underwriting standards. You know, and it's presumed that when someone says, you know, giving that means, oh, wait, this note looks like it's after committee. I'm sorry. I was going to say that despite the language, most people would put a recommendation in the committee memo. But this is a note after the committee. Gee, okay.
Yep,
that's a better record for us to have then, that the committee actually... committee agreed to give some benefit for the underwriting
right.
and agreed to level. Okay.
On the first page in the table, committee levels, there are columns headed B, C, D, E, and F,
mm-hmm.
and then a final column, AG.
Yep.
And as I understand this, and please correct me if I don't understand this, these lettered columns, B through F, denote subpools within the mortgage pool. Do I understand it right? And take your time to take a look.
I'm speculating, though.
Have you ever seen this sort of heading before on a committee memorandum?
Yes.
BC? And what is it typically? I know you weren't on this pool.
The headings would represent subpools.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that's really where I'm at. There's no gotcha
here at all. Yeah, I'm fine. Well, okay, but I'm...
And we can caveat all this. This is based on your understanding of generally the way these documents work, with no specific knowledge of this.
Okay.
Committee. And this was literally pulled at random from the Moody's production. So for that first committee levels, the first row is headed base levels. What is the base level? Can you explain that? A base level for generally this concept of a base level.
Not even if I were there, I wouldn't recall every specific, but this was a level that would have been based on model output and comparables, but that excluded some of the other adjustments that had become reasonably standardized or quite standardized that were known to be made. You can see it was somewhat time. We knew. If you look, I'm sure you'll point me to each of these risk factors. These risk factors had what Moody's believed defined added elements of risk
right.
to the pool, and not being baked into the model, it was helpful to give the adjustment as a separate line item. So if someone else were to do a comparison pool, but not have interest-only loans or not have a reset hit, et cetera, they could still use the Argent pool base levels as a comparison for their pool's base levels.
Yep. That makes sense.
Okay.
And then 9.49, which is the base level for AAA.
Okay.
That's referring to the base level of credit support to be rated AAA. That then will be subject to all these other adjustments.
Yeah,
that's what a level is. A level is a credit support level. Is this right? That's right.
It would mean that if the deal copied the whatever structure was discussed in committee and there is 9.49% credit support behind the single bond, then that single bond would get a AAA rating, again, all else being acceptable to the committee. Subpool B is obviously the strongest. They go in order, strongest to weakest. You can tell by the base levels. And subpool B is a tiny percent of Argent's or AmeriQuest origination, 2.9% in this particular period.
And is this BCDEF subpooling? Was this typically done on deals when you were on committees in 2005, 2006?
It very much depended on the originator and what kind of adjustment you want to make. Like you might separate the pools based on the ones that were interest only, and then you could apply the IO hit just for that part of the pool. So those are reasons for doing it. It could be that the originator wanted to only securitize some of the loans, not others, so they needed this as input. I cannot tell any more than that from just looking at the memos.
Sure, sure. And then on the second page, it has this list called tranche levels. What do tranche levels generally refer to in ratings memos?
Tranches are structured finance, and it's easier to show with a picture, but I know we're recording this. Structured finance usually has a senior most tranche or class. It gets priority to payments, and it gets protected from losses by the subordination of the other classes. But rather than just have a senior bond and then a single subordinated bond, there are investors with a moderate risk appetite who would say, I don't need the senior most bond, but I want some, if you give me some protection behind me, I'm willing to take some measured risk of mortgage decline. So they would ask for a class, you might even see it referred to as a mezzanine class in some cases, that's in the middle. It would absorb losses before the senior bond, but it in turn is protected from losses by a more subordinate bond. And in fact, once you accept that concept, the issuer in theory could issue 100 different tranches, one senior and then more subordinate, more senior, et cetera.
Right.
The most we had seen that were tranched for subordination purposes would be about 15, one at each rating level, and maybe because the rating agencies had different approaches, there would be a couple that we had the same rating for, but yep. S&P might have higher on one and then same on another.
If you could flip to the page marked at the bottom, 8746, it's 7 or 8 pages in.
8764, you mean?
8746 is the Moody's FDIC number.
The very bottom.
Yep, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. It's actually the same one, though.
Yeah. great.
Right.
So there's subpool B is at the top, and it says follow M3 results. Hit at 40% underwriting hit since the data provided, especially cash reserves, is based on underwriting guidelines and not loan by loan.
I'm sorry. You said 8746.
Mm-hmm.
8746. My document seems to end at 8745.
Yeah. I'm sorry. It was a reproduction mistake. Can you look over?
I
apologize.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the follow M3 results.
Okay. So it was decided that subpool B, that must have been part of the alt B benefit that was referred to as having been agreed to in committee, that among this generally subprime originators' originations.
Yep.
There were loans with a loan characteristics and an origination platform metrics or standards where a committee would go with M3
and then
as a starting point. And then the underwriting hit is quite substantial. Right? Normally an originator factor among different prime originators, you might see you know, 5% up or down. In extreme cases, I judge 10% to be an extreme case. Whereas if you take a subprime originator largely following a prime platform, it would be a 40% hit would have been committed in this case.
And this is to capture the higher risk of subprime originated loans, even if they look like prime loans. Moody's view is that on average, they're actually going to be a little riskier than, or 40% riskier. I mean, they have the exact
measure. Yeah, I don't like the exact number for a deal I wasn't on, but it reflects the in-between nature of these loans overall. That a good starting point is M3 with a substantial hit to it.
And how did they figure out what the hit should be?
It was committed.
So a committee would look at it and go, well, we think with this originator, about 40%.
You're making it sound like committee is a short.
No, I sincerely have no idea. I have no idea what goes on in committee.
There would have been either hits or penalties would be determined generally and published in a methodology. Like, these are the elements that lead to a 40% hit, and analysts would apply that to their deals, plus or minus if they thought their originator's case was different than the general rule. Or it's done case by case, and you would look at what this underwriter, I'm sorry, what this originator did for subpool B versus what a normal prime originator does, and hit based on that. You'd also have comparisons. There are other people, you know, Argent might have done a previous pool, subpool that looked like that. That also got a 40% hit, and that might have been taken into account. I don't know how much detail you want on my speculation. They mentioned some deficiency in the cash reserve. So that was one element that this committee would have considered in agreeing that 40% was the appropriate hit.
What would, well, let's go to subpool D.
And it ties well to the point I keep making, that the model is just a tool.
Right.
So it was, you know, which tool with adjustment gives the best result and a better result, most helpful result than others.
For subpool D, which was a fixed rate mortgage,
First lien,
10% of the pool, 10.9% of the pool. It says it compared with RC 2006 W4. Is that another mortgage pool?
Yeah, I think RC sounds also like Argent.
Right.
So, but it may not be. Sometimes originators do that to get, but let's see, what do they call it? W4, and this one 2006 W5.
So
very likely, and the people in committee would have understood that, and certainly the lead analyst who wrote it would have known that.
And it says characteristics are comparable, characteristics are very close to each other, and then has strengths and weaknesses with comparative statements. Slightly better LTV on strengths, on the weaknesses slightly worse FICO. Do I understand this is...
I don't have the model output page here, so I don't... I think that's a summary of the the lead analyst summary of the comparison between this subpool D and the RC deal.
And so typically there would be a model output page that would compare the pool you're rating to the comparable pool.
Typically after I left, I don't know.
No, I'm sorry. Typically when you were there, all this is typically when you were there.
Yeah.
Okay, if I could get that back. We're done with that one.
But that's the one with the good copy, so do you need that and give him the bad one? Or?
It's not that interesting.
We have one from this one. Yeah.
I just want to maybe reuse it with Mr. Stein. So.
Right. I think this one looks like it's better. So.
Okay, great. Okay. Thanks. Okay, here's another committee memo. With hopefully a more complete reproduction.
Still after, do you need a copy for him? And is it?
No, he's not here, so
okay.
When he comes. So this is...
This is now several months after I left.
This is August 29, 2006. The pool is CMLTI 2006-NC2. The Bates number is Moody's FCIC 8593. So on the second page, it says, in the second bullet, ask if New Century would be willing to do a rep for Alt B, i.e. that X percent of loans have reserves greater than 2 months. What does that mean? In general, based on your knowledge, you weren't on this deal.
No, I don't know what that means.
Have you ever heard the term a rep for Alt B?
Rep I've heard used as an abbreviation for representation. So, rep will be representation.
Okay. And then in a loss coverage recommendation, just want to go through the hits and see if you know in general, based on your experience, what these hits represent.
Okay.
So what is a UG hit?
I am guessing underwriting guideline, because the other memo showed underwriting as a first adjustment, and UG does stand for underwriting guideline, among other things. But I, if people reading this would have had her there to say, an underwriting guideline wouldn't fit in this space, so I'm getting more confident in my guess.
IO hit?
That's the interest-only hit. Interest-only loans were roughly 20% riskier, but it can depend on the specific terms of the how long the interest-only period is and how the borrower's payment capacity was underwritten. Were they underwritten to make the full payment, including P&I, or just underwritten to the interest-only period? Are two examples of adjustments to the IO hit versus the 20. That's the general.
And the teaser hit?
Teaser hit was actually, the person who committed this was one of the people who published on the teaser hit. There's an element that we identified where borrowers were taking out loans with low initial payments, and the payment was destined to go up. We call that a teaser rate loan. So Moody's published a methodology on the sorts of increased risk levels that are introduced. It was basically generally loan by loan considered, and I believe modeled. And the bigger your payment shock, your payment would go up, the more payment shock there was, the worse the loan would perform.
Yep.
And that was not based on teasers were new. This is another example where we didn't have historical data going long enough back to see if there would be increased defaults when rates went up, but it was an element that committee would have considered, and then eventually became standardized into a teaser hit calculation and publication.
Yep.
And I suspect ultimately that should be just baked into the core model.
And the SS hit?
Simultaneous second. That's when a borrower takes out an 80 LTV loan is in this pool, and they also borrowed a 290 LTV, meaning 10%,
right.
Usually from another lender, and the information becomes known to us, so we give a hit for that.
And if you could turn to 8596, the bottom number, it's four pages in.
Okay.
On the recommendation rationale, I believe the analyst, or lead analyst, has written, who's making the recommendation to the committee, has written that to determine loss coverage, I will mostly rely on the most recent securitization of New Century collateral by conduit issuers or peers of CMLTI,
mm-hmm.
including most recent includes securitization of this issuer, CMLTI 2006-NC2.
Okay.
What is going on here? What are they trying to communicate to the committee?
New Century is the originator.
Yep.
The loan characteristics, the underwriting history, the quality of the appraisal, etc., all that's driven by New Century. It turns out, though, that Citi, this deal is off of a shelf, so the technical originator, CMLTI, that doesn't stand for New Century. It stands for something like Citicorp Mortgage, something else. So she is indicating that the comparable for the collateral analysis are other New Century deals, whether it was by a different conduit issuer or by CMLT itself, that those all, the product New Century originates for eventual conduit issuance would be comparable regardless of whether Citi happened to be doing this one or Lehman happened to be doing the other one.
So in this case, I will mostly rely on the most recent securitization. This is obviously a reference to the comparison process you described where you find comparison pools. What I can't figure out is to what extent they rely on the comparison pool for loss coverage estimates or on the model output. This seems to suggest
that I know what the words say.
Yeah, the words seem to suggest that they rely mostly on the comparison. Did that kind of thing happen on committees that you were on, where they relied mostly on a comparison, not the model output?
Yeah, there were. To the extent the model output is a tool, right? And I don't know if this would happen with New Century. If there's an originator where you're often a point higher than the model, then you could say I'm relying on the model and adding a point, or you can just go to the final result of the, you know, Mal keeps saying 18, we always committed 19. So if you say I'm relying on this other pool, I was 19, instead of saying I went back to the model and then I added one. You know, it's,
right.
I think I'm explaining factually, but I don't see practically it being terribly different.
Makes sense.
Except I can't say it as to this particular case because I don't have the outputs in front of me.
So if you put now that 8599, which is a couple more pages in, there's at the bottom section 4, treatment of each subpool and loss coverage estimates, which shows where the base level starts for the subpools A, B, C, and D. I don't see E and F, but I think E and F ought to be here as well. So it says the AAA B2 from the LTV column of M3 results for category A, B, and C. What in the world is the LTV column of M3 results?
While Jay is looking at that, were you looking at a page beyond 599 in your document?
Nope.
Okay.
I'd rather not speculate. I have formulated a speculation, but it's simply that. And if I just had any output from any M3 output, I could show you the column you're referring to.
I see. So there's a column in the output labeled LTV. In general, so forget about the time for a second. In general, in the M3 output, there's some column labeled LTV.
I would want to see it and then tell you exactly that. That here's a column they're referring to, and it says LTV. But
I see.
I don't want to speculate that without 4 years later without having the model in front of me.
Yeah. Does LTV stand for anything to your knowledge other than loan to value in these documents?
No, it stands for loan to value ratio.
Okay. Sure. And then it says for category D equals M3 LTV results times 2.5. What's going on there generally?
Do you want me to read the rest of the memo where they talked about how they came up with the results for pools A, B, C, D, E, and F?
I can see why you might want to do that to understand it. But no, we don't have time because I need to let you go in 10 minutes. So if you know, great. If you don't, it's fine.
I know that the other memo you showed me, they made an upward adjustment to the M3 results based on the loan characteristics and the underwriting.
Yep.
But you're not giving me time to read whether that's what's happening here or not.
Fair enough. Well, in the interest of time, and I do want to make good on my promise to end, I will make good. Let me get that back, and we'll go to the final topic. When you were team MD in the RMBS group, did you feel that your group had sufficient resources to do its job?
Yes, I felt we had sufficient resources to do our job.
Did you ever express otherwise to colleagues?
As to part of that, I might have said that we didn't have sufficient resources to achieve a good work-life balance, or work-life balance that's comparable to other teams at Moody's. So I certainly expressed that to people. But the team kept growing while I was there. We got sufficient resources to do the job.
So you felt like the resources you were given had a negative impact on work-life balance for members of the group?
Yes.
Yeah, but it didn't affect the output of the group, that is the work, the quality of the work the group did.
I tried to get 5 hours sleep a night and didn't usually, and others were, Michael Kenneth would often stay for dinner, which usually start around 8, and there were always many people from the RMBS team there, so it was a tough environment for people, given how many hands we had on board. But we certainly had enough for rating quality and core functions of the job, even non-core. We did investor briefings. When I first got there, we didn't do investor briefings. So doing the job worked out fine. Work-life balance was. I even had to change my interview pitch. I mean, I used to tell people when I first got there, and this had happened to me as well, leaving the law firm, you don't have to count all-nighters, you don't have to count double all-nighters.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, you might get home when the sun's out. And then after about a year or two, I said, you're at a place where people, the managers would prefer it to be that you get home when the sun is out, but I can't promise you that's happened. Talk to the analyst. And then near the end, I just said, it used to be a place where we promised people to get home, but I don't say that anymore because it just, time and again, it doesn't happen, but we offer, it's good training, it's good exposure, and the pay starts out being comparable to what offers you might get right now. Eventually, people could make more money leaving, but...
Was there sufficient resources devoted to model development, in your view?
What time period again? When I did M3 or what?
Let's say between 2004 and the time you left in 2006.
See, what were we developing? So I guess you're talking about like subprime M3?
I'm not talking about anything, but other than general,
well,
your RMBS.
Prime M3 had been, I just want to make sure I'm not getting confused the time pressure with the dates. Prime had come out. Right. So, subprime, we got Roger Stein and his team. I mean, that was, and he had several people on his team.
Yeah.
Sorry. So I think it was sufficient. It's always a trade-off. But it was sufficient for the analytics to be right. The analyst used to have to make all these little adjustments outside of committee. So if he had more people, would our analysts have spent less time on the adjustments? Possibly incrementally, but it was really work-life balance.
I want to show you an email chain that you were on from January 2006. This is labeled
the
bottom.
Underlining that I have?
Yep.
Is this underlining part of the...
That's, I guess, my underlying.
Right. You want to trade?
Sure. But actually, it does draw your attention to the relevant point, doesn't it? So it's labeled PSI Moody's 5.8. Why don't you take a second just to refresh your recollection of the issues discussed in the email? Thank you.
two pages?
It's just on the reverse. So.
Yeah, but, okay. My reply email has a longer list than Roger's email.
Yeah, it does. This is the... Oh, I got.
Okay. All right. I don't think I wrote from scratch some of these elements that I'm referring to as priorities. I seem to list roughly on glance six priorities, and three of them copy Roger's language and in my comments are in parentheticals, and three of them, I don't know where they come from, but I still have comments on parentheticals in them, so they came from somewhere. Okay. All right. And Mark agrees. And then, okay. All right, so then I guess we've had discussions from what Warren says. I agree, I wrote this. I don't know if I agree, I understand now what each of the like shorthands are and like data set and all that.
That's okay.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
So
I bet I know because of what you're underlining.
Well, let's start actually with non-underlined things, which is. One of the items mentioned in Warren Kornfeld's email at the end of it is to revise simulation methodology for prime and subprime M3.
This is on?
On the reverse, the top of the reverse.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then in your email from January 18th, on the first page, you wrote, the simulation should not require any data, just a quant, look at historical unemployment, home price, and interest rate movements. What was the revision? Do you recall what the revision was that was planned at that point?
You said something first, so I want to clarify that.
Please.
Warren says, I put a question as to whether we want to expand the data set prior to beginning the simulation, or do we have enough data? So Warren has separately from the list asked if we need to expand the data set in order to do the simulation. So my answer, my first sentence addresses the question he put in his first paragraph. So the simulation should not require any data is what I'm saying, just to look at the historical economic data, just like I explained to you. Okay.
So then what was the revision that was being planned?
Okay. So now, point again to which revision are you referring to?
So
one
the original reference is going to say, it says revised simulation methodology for prime and subprime.
Yeah, and so then what I'm talking about, whether it needs... Yeah.
And this is January 2006, just to help jog.
Right. Making a revised simulation... I think it refers to an issue you raised in one of your much earlier questions, that as more data economic environments become available, it provides more, I'll call it data points for which to simulate the economic environments going forward. So from my interpretation, colored by vague recollection, is that we were at the point where one thing we wanted Roger's team to do was look at the economic environment through January 2006 and use that to simulate economic paths both for prime and subprime.
So,
and the economic paths was the one thing that could be constant or consistent between the prime and subprime models. It doesn't matter what the origination platform is, the U.S. Treasury rate would be the same. It might have different risk weightings, right? Like subprime borrowers might be more sensitive to a rise in short-term rate than long-term than prime borrowers.
Yep.
But so that's why it's referred to as being both for prime and subprime.
And do you recall what the concern was about the economic simulations that prompted the revision?
I don't have any recollection that there was a particular concern with the economic simulations.
Were they revised every January? I mean, was this...
Now, remember, each quarter we had the new starting point.
Sorry.
So,
but this is something beyond that quarterly.
This is going back and redoing the underlying vectors, not just taking into account the new economy, which I consider as maintaining current M3 product.
Yep, makes total sense.
That would be the part that I described as mechanical. Right? That the quants were doing. So maintenance, using current data as a starting point and preceding few quarters as a starting point was one thing. This I took to mean something beyond that, just redoing the vectors.
How many times did you redo the vectors during your time as Team MD?
As I described, we did not redo the vectors based on economic. There were times where we may have in the beta testing and said, oh, look, these pools are too sensitive. So we may have changed that, but they were not done to reflect movements in the economic environment.
To your knowledge, since January 18, 2006, when these emails were written, have the economic simulations been revised? Meaning the revision this is talking about, not the quarterly mechanical one.
And the question is whether...
Do I know?
Since he left?
No, since January 2006, which would include the time he left, as well as the balance of your time at Moody's.
Put in through today.
Through today, yes.
No, I don't know. I did review for comment one of the reports that Roger put out, and I will admit it may have said whether or not he did that in that report, but right now, this is 3 years after reviewing that report, I don't know.
But you didn't. It's safe to say you didn't work on revising them.
No. I would have. I mean, I explained how Prime M3 worked,
yep,
so if Roger may or may not have taken from that. But I didn't work on that. No,
you were busy collecting blood, let's hope. I'm going to let you go because we're at our time, but I may well want to follow up with you with some other details. But if so, we'll contact Mr. Ross and see.
Do you have a time frame? Because
I'm
really out of pocket while my father is going through his...
I understand. I don't have a time frame. I'm not quite sure I need to... we have a hearing coming up, obviously, in a few weeks, and exactly what we'll want to do before and after that hearing, I'm not sure, but we'll let you know. And if you're out of pocket, it's we'll wait. So until you're back, this is incredibly helpful. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Two things. One, just I would remind you about our question about confidentiality earlier.
One thing I wrote down.
And two is if you remember anything differently, if you remember anything additional. If you could, through Mr. Ross, bring that to our attention, we appreciate it. I've got 205, and we'll go off record. Thank you.
Thank you.